It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
I love you, Solo!
Mama Monster!
Conquered! I'm home!
I want your soul.
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me!
Is that Pat Patterson?
You have legs.
Holy mackerel, did he get fat!
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want!
This is episode 910. Of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Easter Sunday, April 20th, 2025. I want to wish a very happy Easter to all celebrating. It also happens to be night two of WrestleMania 41. We are now halfway through WrestleMania. I am a very sleepy Solo Monster coming off of a very late night one review. And we killed it last night. Hopefully we'll do the same tonight. But obviously I am going to have some thoughts on WrestleMania night one, which was the big news of the weekend, but hardly the only big news of the weekend. There was actually a huge news story that broke yesterday involving WWE that I'm going to get into here in a few minutes. We got a lot of stuff to get into. There's a lot of other news and notes. I got news and notes on AEW, as well as New Japan, which had some big news of its own. And then a little bit later on, probably at the very end of the review, I'm going to be including my full WrestleMania 9 documentary review. Becoming a Spectacle, WrestleMania 9, The Making Of, is now on Peacock. I did watch it. I did review it on YouTube. It went up during the week. Not everybody is on YouTube, and I didn't have a chance to include it in the podcast last weekend, so you're going to get it this week. And so the full review will be up towards the end of the show for those of you who want to tune into that. I got some great feedback on that, and hopefully you will enjoy it. But yeah, a lot to get into here on a very busy weekend, and I thank you for joining me for your WrestleMania coverage. If you would like to make a PayPal donation, as many of you did this week, you guys blew me away, thesolomonster.com. It never changes. That's the place to go. You'll see the link at the top of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. Like these fine folks, Gravedigger, Brandon DeBlanc. Brandon, thank you very much. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. Hey, 7 is my lucky number. So thank you, brother. Big B, Bryant Becerra. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Five Tool Player, Adam Bartolo. Number one in the division, brother. Fast Blast, Tim Banks. Tough Guy, Temjin Zephyr. Congrats on the new job. Only good things from here on out, Temjin. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert. Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar. The Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton. The Georgia Nightmare, Timothy Tillis. Best in the Game, Trey Porter. Killshot, Keith Hart. Nemesis, Nathan Moyers, who says that John Cena is going to tap out tonight. A bold prediction there from Nathan. I don't know about tapping out. What would he tap out to? Cody is not known as a submission specialist. And Sepia Prince, thank you very much for the nice words. Thank you all. It was very, very nice to see all of the support this week, not only on YouTube, but here for the main show as well. This Friday, House of Glory presents Isolation at the NYC Arena with Konosuke Takeshita making his HOG debut. He's going to be taking on our world champion Mike Santana. And the TNA Knockouts champion, Masha Slamovich, makes her HOG return as well. Bell time is 8 p.m. Tickets are available at hogwrestling.net. Or you can stream the show live on Triller TV Plus. I will not be there. I'm flying to Chicago for a wedding. And so there will be no SmackDown review. Well, I mean, there wouldn't be anyway. I would be at the Hog Show if I was here. But there will be no SmackDown review this Friday, which sucks because I know it's going to be the biggest SmackDown of the year. Coming out of WrestleMania, but just be aware of that. There will be no SmackDown review on Friday night. There will be no new Sound Off next Sunday. So I just want to make everybody aware of that. That means I'll be back here in 2 weeks with episode 911. If you send in any PayPals this week for roll call, send them on in, and I will include them on the next show. So there's no worries there. I got to start with the bombshell announcement yesterday that was made on the WrestleMania kickoff show. That WWE has purchased one of the two biggest Lucha Libre promotions in Mexico, AAA. which was founded in 1992 when Antonio Peña, who was the booker for CMLL, split with them. He took Conan with him. He took a lot of the young CMLL talent with him. I talked about this once before, I think in a This Week in History segment. CMLL being the biggest promotion in Mexico and the one that happens to work with AEW right now. In fact, AEW just announced their first show ever in Mexico just this week is going to be held at Arena Mexico. It's going to be an episode of Dynamite on June 18th. But that news has been completely overshadowed by the announcement that AAA is now under TKO ownership. Triple H and Michael Cole, they were joined on set on the pre-show by AAA president Marisela Peña, her son AAA general manager Dorian Roldan Peña, AAA star Vikingo was there, which was wild to see Triple H introducing Vikingo. Rey Mysterio, Dragon Lee, Joaquin Wilde, Cruz del Toro, Penta, Rey Fénix, Santos Escobar, Angel Humberto, Andrade, and Stephanie Vaquer were all flanking Triple H and Michael Cole and all of the executives on set. Triple H is where Rey Mysterio got his first break in wrestling. I mean, he goes back to the very first year. And he was on that first Worlds Collide pay-per-view in 1994 that Triple H produced with WCW. And on that note, the other part of their announcement was the return of Worlds Collide, which will be a cross-promotional event with WWE and AAA, or NXT and AAA, but I'm sure they'll have main roster talent on the show since they were present for the announcement. And I think all three logos are in the WWE, NXT, and AAA. I believe all the logos are represented in the poster. Saturday, June 7th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's noon local time from the Kia Forum in Los Angeles, which is a big building. So they're definitely using main roster names on that show. They shot an angle last night at WrestleMania to set up Vikingo against El Grande Americano if they want to do it. Not saying they will, but they certainly did something on the show last night that would be very easy to put that match together if they wanted to do so. I'm guessing a 3 p.m. start time, which is noon local time, because June 7th has been rumored as the date for Money in the Bank, also in Los Angeles, which makes more sense now. We have no details beyond that. As I sit here right now, we do not know anything as far as what kind of money is involved. We don't know how they intend to run the promotion going forward, how much influence they're going to have over creative, if they're going to be cutting people. You know, Alberto Del Rio works for AAA, even though he got suspended recently for 6 months. I think it was only in Tijuana. But he was suspended for getting into a fight in the crowd at a show. So Del Dipshit, still doing Del Dipshit things. You know, what does that mean for his future there? I don't know. I believe Marty Scurll still works for AAA. We don't know. The answer is we don't know right now. You know, when WWE bought WCW, if you remember, they grabbed the IP and the tape library and a handful of contracts, not a lot of big names. And they chose not to run it as a separate entity, even though that was the original plan. They bought Evolve about 5 or 6 years ago from Gabe Sapolsky. But same thing, it was just the name and the library. And now they're using the Evolve name for one of their developmental shows. I don't think they're closing down AAA, but how it's going to be run going forward will be very interesting to see. You know, at the post-show scrum last night, Triple H said he's looking to keep, quote, traditional lucha libre as traditional lucha libre and help it grow. And I saw Lucha Blog made a great point. The problem is that AAA never was traditional lucha libre. It was founded on the idea that lucha libre needed to change. And it's like they're trying to say the right things, but they seem to know very little about what they're actually talking about. I've heard people say that as far back as the 90s, you know, AAA was trying to be more like WWE or WCW than they were so-called traditional lucha libre. They do a lot of wacky stuff. So if you're a fan of the current AAA product, and I don't know how many people are anymore because AAA has not been doing great. I mean, they're not CMLL. CMLL is the top lucha promotion certainly in that country, if not the world. Yeah, there's been talk of money issues with AAA, issues with Conan's booking. They sound like a company that's been looking to make a deal for a while. And what it does is it gives WWE a huge presence now in a market that they did not traditionally have a big presence in. This is part of their global expansion. I've talked about this before. Remember that map that Triple H showed at some conference? I don't remember what the event was, but there was this giant map many years ago with all the different places they wanted to expand NXT. It was their plans for a global territory system. It was their plan for world domination. This was actually, it was 2018. It was a couple of years before Triple H had his heart issue. You know, NXT Europe, which never got off the ground. But this is what the vision was. And now they have a pipeline to a ton of lucha talent, which gives them a competitive advantage over everybody else. You know, just like the WWE ID program gives them a competitive advantage when it comes to recruiting indie talent. Right? They've got first dibs now early on the people they might want to bring in. Trust me, this has more to do with benefiting WWE than it does benefiting Lucha Libre. Okay, if you think they give a shit about traditional Lucha Libre, you've got a lot to learn. But what it also does is it puts WWE now in direct competition with CMLL, which is the oldest promotion in the world. This is basically a declaration of war on CMLL. AAA and CMLL, they already didn't get along, but this takes it to a whole new level. And it makes more sense now why CMLL would want to partner with AEW. But this is only just the beginning. We're going to see more of this as the months and years go on. They're going to go from partnership mode to acquisition mode when it suits their needs. So right now they have a multi-year partnership with TNA. And I think that works for them. I really don't see the need for them to acquire TNA right now. But it could be a precursor to them doing just that at some point. Same with Pro Wrestling Noah in Japan. Right? They have a partnership with them. AEW has the partnership with New Japan. AEW has worked with Stardom. So WWE goes and works with Marigold. It's all very interesting, isn't it? That's not a coincidence. Now, it was WrestleMania week, so there have been tons of WWE names out doing press and giving interviews to various outlets. And what a shit show it turned into. Talking about politics and Vince McMahon and AEW. These people have spent more time talking about Tony Khan than they have WrestleMania. Yet John Cena, speaking with the New York Times, doubling down on his love and affection for Vince McMahon, which is nothing new. I mean, he already did this once before on the Howard Stern show. We know how he feels. And, you know, if he wants to publicly profess his love for Vince, he's certainly entitled to do so, just as people are entitled to be repulsed by it. And he chose to say what he said. He wasn't prodded on, like, how do you feel about Vince McMahon? The question was, how does it feel to be at the end of your career without Vince being around for it? And he went out of his way to profess his love for the man because that's how he really feels. And of course he does. He was homeless at one point. He was sleeping in his Lincoln Town Car when he first drove out to LA to make it big. He went from being homeless and sleeping in his car to being a multimillionaire because Vince McMahon chose him to be the face of his company. Now he's a big movie star. He's making more money than he'll ever be able to spend. Of course he's going to love that man. But I have far more respect for people like Seth Rollins and Kevin Owens and Bret Hart, who also made millions working for Vince McMahon and have had the decency to say, you know what? If the allegations are true, it's disgusting and the people involved should get what's coming to them. I think that was what Seth said. That's it. That's really all that needs to be said. And the fact that some people are not able to bring themselves to do that is disappointing, but it's not surprising. Now, Nick Khan was a guest on the Bill Simmons podcast. And Simmons asked him whether he feels WWE has a rival, and specifically citing AEW when he says that, you know, he feels their moment came and went and they're firmly number two now, to which Khan responded like this. We're always the underdog at WWE. We always feel that people underestimate us, that we are looked down upon, and we like it that way. Bet against us. We prefer that. And allow us to show you what we can do. If you look at the stock price now, it's far in excess of what it was when we all started together 5 years ago. and we're quite proud of that. At the same time, we have to keep re-earning our keep on a daily basis here. So we feel like it's a good moment, but we feel like there is a lot of room for growth. You know, it's one thing to say that there's room for growth. It's another to frame yourself as the underdog, which of course is laughable. He said, in terms of the other wrestling promotional company, which is certainly one way of putting it, they have a lot of talented wrestlers, and we're happy about that. When contractually they're able to be talked to and have conversations with, assume a number of them will come over. And nothing but respect for the father who finances it and owns the Jaguars and all of those other things. Wow. If you want to know how little respect they have for Tony Khan, just the contempt that they have for him and for what he has done with AEW, there it is. I mean, it's all laid bare right there in that quote. Like even the stuff with Sting not inducting Lex Luger into the Hall of Fame this week, like they could have made the first contact and reached out to Tony to see if he would allow Sting to do it. You know, Luger was very public and said he told the company he specifically asked for Sting. He was his first choice to be his inductor. But they never did because they cannot even bring themselves to pick up the phone and reach out. They have such a disdain for them. I mean, it just jumps off the page. And hey, fair play. It's not like Tony Khan hasn't taken shots at them before, you know, calling them the Harvey Weinstein of pro wrestling and all that. But there's a lot of bitterness and pettiness on both sides of the coin. Him saying he respects the father who finances it implies that he has no respect for the son who is only using daddy's money, you know, as if Tony was just laying on the couch eating Cheetos and watching reruns of Beavis and Butthead when he got the idea to start AEW. I mean, this is right out of the Vince McMahon playbook. Vince did the same thing in the 90s, only back then it was Eric Bischoff spending Ted Turner's money and throwing shade at them for that. You know, maybe they're upset that they have to pay their talent a lot more now than they used to, because guess what? That's what competition does. That's why I've always said competition is a great thing. You don't even have to watch AEW. Just be happy that competition exists. You don't have to watch a single second of Dynamite to be able to appreciate the fact that, you know what? It's a good thing that there is at least one other promotion with a national presence or a global presence that can compete on some level, even if only for talent, that can compete with WWE. And maybe that's what they're ultimately really upset about. Because Tony has the money to throw around to compete for the same talent. Because remember, whatever you think about WWE being so much bigger and stronger than AEW, they're both competing for talent from the same talent pool. You know, WWE is competing with AEW every single day for the same talent. You saw some of those talents on the WrestleMania card this year. You saw some last night. You had Ricky Starks at Stand and Deliver. Rey Fénix on WrestleMania. And when you have a competitor with money to throw around, what it does is it forces you to spend more money even when you don't want to. That's why you heard the reports about WWE allegedly, and I have to stress allegedly, this wasn't something that was said publicly, but there were reports last year. Yeah, you know, they were throwing shade at Swerve Strickland, getting so much money from AEW on his new contract when he re-signed with them last year, how they're paying him so much more above market value and so much more than what he's worth. It's going to force them to have to do the same thing. I'm sure that's part of it. I'm sure that's part of the disdain they have for this man. You know, you had Stephanie Vaquer on a radio show this week talking about how she turned down more money from AEW to sign with WWE. And when WWE found out, they told her to go sign with them. Like, they weren't going to be able to match what Tony was offering. But it was Shawn Michaels who convinced her not to do it. Is her going out there and saying that part of a concerted effort on WWE's part to put stories like that out there to tell people, hey, the grass isn't always greener on the other side. We may not offer you the same amount of money those guys are, but look at what we've done with Stephanie. Look at all the success that she's had so far. Look at what we can do for you. Maybe. Maybe it is. But even if it's not part of some concerted effort, I'm sure they love her putting that story out there. So when Simmons then warned Nick Khan about signing too many people to the point where others on the roster may end up sitting in the back and not being used, you know, you only have so many spots to go around. This was Nick Khan's response. Look, that's something we won't do. We won't sign and bench people. We sign people who we want to use. And when Simmons pointed out that that's happened in the past in WWE, maybe before Khan's time, he said, perhaps, but in terms of the other wrestling promotional company, if another entity signs and benches people, that is not something that we would do. So, two things on that. First of all, he's being disingenuous when he says that we don't sign people just to bench them like AEW does. He's obviously referring to people like Ricky Starks and Phoenix and Miro, all of whom are now with WWE. Big E the other day let the cat out of the bag, and he flat out said that Rusev was back with the company, even though nothing's been announced. We may see him tonight. It's not like Tony Khan literally signed all of those people and then never used them. Like, you can throw Camille in there too. All of them were used at one time or another, but then, yes, they ended up on the bench and they were never heard from again. The Camille thing is still something I don't understand. I mean, they even went out of their way to not talk about her when they were promoting Queen of the Ring, which she starred in, had a pretty significant role in. But they used her for a few months and then they took her off TV. Ricky Starks, he won the FTW title. He won the Owen Hart tournament. He even got a win over CM Punk, who just headlined WrestleMania last night. He was one half of their tag team champions. And then he got benched when Tony realized that he wanted to leave and go to WWE. Same thing with Rey Fénix. And there's no excuse for keeping people on ice for months on end just because you think, oh, they want to leave. You know, and I'm glad he ended up giving them all an early release from their contracts. They would still be sitting at home right now if he had not done that. So he's being somewhat disingenuous when he says that in the way that he does. But he's also a hypocrite. That was the most hypocritical part of the entire interview. When you have someone like Omos being called back from Japan so urgently he had to vacate his half of the GHC tag team titles, right, just to come home and do what exactly? Nothing. They've done nothing with him on TV. And even before that, they were doing nothing with him then. Like, legitimately, the last time he competed in a WWE ring was last year's Andre the Giant Battle Royal. And I know Muda had said he wanted him there in Noah, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was something that Omos himself lobbied for, to go over there. You know, send me to Japan. If you're not going to use me, this guy wants to use me, send me to Japan. I can improve. I can learn. It's not like they have him working house shows, which for him is something he could probably benefit from. They hardly even do house shows anymore. Fucking Alexa Bliss comes back at the Royal Rumble, gets one of the biggest reactions of anybody on the entire show. Then she works the Elimination Chamber, and then she hasn't been seen since. And all because why? One member of the Wyatt Six got hurt? Sucks to be the other four people in the group. They haven't been seen or heard from either. Maybe they will this week, coming out of WrestleMania, right? Hikuleo! What the fuck ever happened to Hikuleo? He got signed last year. He hasn't been seen or heard from since. Did he get lost on his way to the PC? Did he get kidnapped in the NXT parking lot and nobody bothered to send a search party to find him? You know, I saw Sean Ross Sapp. He had a great idea. These wrestlers need to start working with their agents to get inactivity clauses included in their contracts. I think that's a great idea. I don't know what the language would have to be on that, but I think that's something that should be explored in both companies. At least in AEW, though, you do have the ability to get yourself booked on the indies, so you can still work somewhere. If let's say, Tony isn't using you, you could still technically work somewhere else. In WWE, that's very rare. But I think that's a great idea. Honestly, that should be explored with both companies. It is interesting, though, you know, how things have flipped from 4 or 5 years ago when people were fleeing WWE to come to AEW. And now it's the reverse. And as was the case with AEW, if WWE is not careful, they're going to sign so many people that they will have no choice but to make roster cuts. I think that's exactly what's going to end up happening, possibly as soon as post-WrestleMania. I mean, they do cuts periodically anyway, but you're going to see a wave of them if this keeps up. And then you had Triple H, Mr. Hall of Fame, being interviewed by Peter Rosenberg and going off on fans who criticize the product. I always love this. He also talked about websites that leak surprises and how they ruin it for everybody else. See, that I can understand. But he specifically popped off on websites and on podcasts like this one and people who consider themselves critics. He wishes he could tell all of the critics to fuck off with being a critic and just be a fan. Just watch the product and be a fan. Just shut up and enjoy the ride, basically. And then he used this terrible movie analogy to try to make his point. I'm sure he thought it sounded good when he came up with it. Sounds to me like someone isn't getting the glowing praise that he got last year for the WrestleMania build, and it's gotten under his skin. Because I didn't hear this out of his mouth last year. Only now, after he's been taking it on the chin for the build to this year's show. He sounded awfully defensive this week. There are critics, and then there are so-called critics who deal in bad faith. Okay, you have those too. I think you have way more of those with AEW than you do the WWE product. Because for all the things that I could criticize AEW for, and I have, there are people who will literally shit on the product no matter what. Like, without even watching it. It's just very bizarro behavior. So I just find that to be pathetic. But there's nothing wrong with being a critic. Like, just speaking for myself, I'm not someone who's critical for the sake of being critical. I will criticize something when it deserves to be criticized, and I will praise it when it deserves praise. You know, I don't come on these shows and feel obligated to criticize something. If there's something, let's say if there's a show that I absolutely just unabashedly love from top to bottom, which was not night one of WrestleMania last night, but let's say there is, and I think, man, if I don't find something to hate, they're going to skewer me for being a dick rider, right? I don't think like that. If I like the show, I love the show, I'm going to tell you I love the show. And if that's what they want to say, then so be it. I get it the other way too, where there'll be a show that I hate, and then I'm, oh, you're just a hater. You just hate on everything. You just hate for the sake of hating, right? I always say, when I get it from both sides, I know I'm doing something right. But I'm just giving my opinions. You could agree with them, you can disagree with them, but that's what I do. No different than sports talk radio or movie critics or literally every other fucking form of entertainment on the planet. I don't know why Kratos over here thinks wrestling should be any different. Like, I get it. He wishes kayfabe was alive and well and that we could go back to the Stone Age where there was no internet. I would also love to go back to when I was 7 watching wrestling and didn't know that half the roster was made up of absolute fucking brain dead idiots in real life. But that's not how life works. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. When you're hungry and you want to go out to dinner, you want to have options, right? Maybe you're in the mood for Chinese or Italian, maybe Japanese food or Indian food, whatever it may be. You have options. Now imagine if you could only get food from one country, one cuisine. That wouldn't be so fun, would it? I love Chinese food, but I don't want to eat it every day. I would be 400 pounds. That's what it's like to use Netflix without ExpressVPN. You only get to watch content from a single country. Where's the fun in that? See, Netflix hides content from you based on your location. ExpressVPN allows you to change your online location so you can control where Netflix thinks you're located. They have servers in over 100 countries, so you can access thousands of new shows and movies and never run out of stuff to watch. And it doesn't just work with Netflix, it works with other streaming services too, like Disney+. ExpressVPN is the best VPN because not only is it secure, it's easy to use. Just tap the app and click one button to change your location. It also works on all of your devices, including phones, laptops, tablets, and smart TVs. You get super fast speed so you can stream in HD without buffering, like you're watching something in 360p. We've all been there before. I don't want to sit here watching a pixelated image. There's a reason why ExpressVPN is ranked number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge, because it just works. I'll give you an example of something I watched or rewatched recently because it came up on one of my live streams. I was interacting with some folks in the chat and The Shawshank Redemption came up. One of the greatest films ever made. And it's not even available on Netflix in the US right now. But you know where you can stream it on Netflix right now? In Australia, and Italy, and Japan. So guess what I did? I traveled, sort of, to Japan for the first time by connecting to a server in Tokyo, and I was able to watch the movie glitch-free, no issues at all. There was a show I recently watched. I only got through a couple of episodes. I may go back to it. But it was a TV series called Hannibal, with Lawrence Fishburne, about Hannibal Lecter and his relationship with a profiler who works for the FBI. Interesting stuff. Didn't even know about it. It's from like 2013. It's not on US Netflix. So I had to connect to a UK server to be able to see it. Again, it's very simple. I just opened the ExpressVPN app, selected the country I wanted, tapped one button. You have to refresh Netflix, but after you do that, there it is. It's just there. I love it. So be smart. Stop paying full price for streaming services and only getting access to a fraction of their content. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/solomonster. And don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/solomonster to get an extra 4 months of ExpressVPN for free. Last night was WrestleMania Saturday, which was a very middle-of-the-road show, capped off by an excellent main event with Seth Rollins beating Roman Reigns and CM Punk and pinning Roman Reigns after a triple cross by Paul Heyman, who leaves with Seth Rollins at the end of the night. He didn't just double-cross Punk, he double-crossed his tribal chief as well, which ends a 5-year partnership that completely transformed Roman's career. It was the beginning of the Tribal Chief and the death of the Big Dog when they linked him with Heyman for the first time, and they got more mileage out of it than I thought they would. I mean, they lasted together about as long as The Undertaker and Paul Bearer did. 5 years, right, before Paul Bearer turned on him. Something about people named Paul. You can't trust them. But CM Punk finally got his WrestleMania main event, and it's up there with his Hell in a Cell match with Drew McIntyre as one of the best matches he's had since coming back to the company. I still put the Hell in a Cell match above this one, but it's right behind that one. Punk was on the Masked Man show this week. He said WWE is trying to get him to sign a 5-year deal, and he's not sure. I don't know if he's got 5 more years of matches like this one in him, but this one was great. And he also said that if he was in Triple H's spot, he would have had Rhea Ripley, Bianca Belair, and Io Sky main event WrestleMania. Although he didn't say which night. Obviously, he's referring to his spot in night one because Cody and John Cena were always going to get night two. But it's funny, you know, with the whole narrative of him wanting to headline WrestleMania. He did want to headline WrestleMania 12 years ago. And he said the reason he wanted a main event WrestleMania was because when you main evented, you got paid more money. Today, you don't have that issue. You know, and he's making a lot more money now than he was back then anyway. But you don't get a big bonus, you know, for main eventing WrestleMania, I don't think. And he makes plenty of money as it is. So he really legitimately does not give a shit whether he main events WrestleMania or not. That's just the storyline. But it was the highlight of an otherwise very mid show. The match itself had, it was a lot of dramatic near falls, a lot of finisher spam. Some people like that, some people don't. It doesn't always bother me. There are times. It really just depends on the match. It's kind of a case-by-case thing with me. If they structure the match in a certain way, they tell a certain story, I can overlook it. Did they go overboard with the near falls? Yeah, probably. But like the Ospreay and Takeshita match from Dynamite this week, where you had that same issue, like, I loved it. And it didn't take me out of the match. It didn't bother me. The fans certainly didn't seem to mind. They were hanging on to every near fall, but really all built to Paul Heyman's involvement. What was Paul Heyman going to do at the end of this match? And sure enough, he grabs a chair, and Roman is on the mat, and he's looking out at Heyman. Punk's on the mat, he's looking out at Heyman, and they both want Heyman to hand him the chair. What is he going to do? And he slides the chair to Punk, and it looks like he's made his choice, and then he climbs into the ring. So that right there screamed, angle alert, something's about to go down. Because why is he getting into the ring? And Punk is limping over towards Roman, who's on the mat. He's going to hit him with this chair. And then Heyman drops to his knee, and he delivers a low blow to CM Punk. Which I don't believe is the first time that that's happened. I know he hit him in the head with a ladder once at one of the Money in the Bank shows. I want to say he gave him a low blow too, but I don't remember. But you would think this guy would learn. So this is the second time now that Paul Heyman in his career has turned on CM Punk. And it looked like he was going to hand the chair off to Roman Reigns, which he did. And he was just going to be back with Roman. And Roman really laid into Punk with that chair. And then Heyman looked over and saw Seth Rollins pulling himself back up to his feet. And he starts telling Roman, my tribal chief, look, the shield. The shield, right? Because Seth was in the same position that Roman was in years ago with his back turned. And now Roman can dish out the same thing to Seth that Seth did to him when he broke up the shield. And he's getting ready to do so. And that's when Paul Heyman, he lowers the boom. And boy, did he ever on Roman Reigns. He gave him a low blow, the likes of which I have not seen in a very long time. He got all up in Roman's business. I mean, he got all of it. I mean, he was going back and forth. And so Roman Reigns now goes down to the mat. And this all leads to Seth Rollins pinning Roman Reigns and winning the triple threat match. And Paul Heyman had a big fat smile on his face. He had made his decision. We don't know how long in advance, but he made his decision clearly long ago, it looks like. And the two of them left together. So I thought the way that they executed it was flawless. It came across just great. One of the all-time like WrestleMania shocking moments. Even if you saw it coming, it was just executed very well. And with nothing on the line coming into the match, you kind of felt like something big has to go down here at the end, and they did. You know, they gave you the biggest possible thing they could do with no title on the line. So now where to next? Is this going to be tied into tonight's main event? Because we got John Cena and Cody Rhodes yet to come tonight. It's only hours away from now. And I was left last night with the impression that this may tie into that in some way. I'm trying to connect the dots here. And maybe I'm connecting dots that aren't there. But I just feel like this is going to play into the main event tonight in some way. Are we looking at Seth Rollins assisting John Cena in winning number 17 tonight? And an alliance of Cena, Rock, Rollins, and Heyman. So I do think Rock is going to be on the show. You know, is that what we're looking at? Are we looking at some kind of new unholy alliance here? Is this going to force Roman Reigns and CM Punk and Cody Rhodes to put all of their differences aside and come together to fight them off? And I got to give a shout out to the Wicker Man on Twitter who wrote me with the idea that, you know, if Roman and Punk do team up eventually to fight Rollins, if he needs a partner, maybe Drew McIntyre can fill that spot. Because who hates Roman and Punk as much as he does? So there's a lot of fun possibilities here if they explore them. I'm approaching this with great caution because what we got coming out of Cena's heel turn at Elimination Chamber was anything but fun. It was very underwhelming. That's what that was. But the potential is there for them to do some fun stuff coming out of this. Now, we also had three title changes on the show. Jey Uso is the new World Heavyweight Champion with a win over Gunther. Not only did he beat Gunther and win the title, he tapped him out a little too quickly. Gunther tapped out almost immediately in the sleeper hold. So that was my one thing I didn't like about it. But Jey Uso is now the new World Champion. And so with Rollins going heel with Heyman, and Rollins is a Raw guy, he should be the one to take that title away from Jey. I don't see Jey Uso having that title for very long. In fact, I think he may have just wound up with the championship to be a transitional champion, just to get the belt onto Seth, because you need a babyface to do that. Which is why Gunther losing it makes sense. That and for the story they told with Jey, Gunther had to lose. I know that upsets a lot of people because they didn't want to see Gunther lose to this guy. They didn't want to see him lose to the Yeet Man. It's a day of mourning for all the Gunther fans out there, but he had to. With the story they were telling, he had to lose. If Jey went in there last night 0-3 and lost again, he was done for as a top guy that anybody could take seriously. At that point, he really does just become the Yeet Man and nothing more. Like, he had to go in. There's like the Rocky story. He had to go in there and get his redemption and finally win and prove that he could hang. And that's what they did. But yeah, I said this in my review last night. And again, the full review where I get into more in the weeds on this, that's up right now on the YouTube channel. I'll put the audio out separately. But you know, what I said was this, to me, the whole Jey Uso thing was more about the moment. It was more about the payoff. It's the dog catching the car. And then once the dog catches the car, it's like the dog doesn't know what to do because he got the car. Like, you already saw the best part. That's how I look at this Jey Uso thing. I look at it as a situation where he's not meant to have any sort of lengthy title run. We already saw the peak. The peak was last night. That great moment in front of, you know, 60,000 people. His brother comes out and embraces him at the end of the match. It's very much like Kofi Mania in 2019. Kofi Mania took the world by storm and they leaned into it. And he had this match with Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania 35. And it was this great moment when he beat Bryan and won the championship. You have people in the crowd crying, and Kofi's family's in the ring with him. His son is in the ring. The New Day guys are in there. And Kofi had been, even then, he was kind of like the elder statesman. He had been there for so long. So it was this great moment. But I don't know that anybody honestly expected Kofi Kingston to go on and have some kind of tremendously successful, long, historic, memorable championship run. It was all about the moment. They capitalized on the emotion of the moment. They didn't have some kind of long-term plan for him as the champion. Now, he had the title for 6 months. It was a very uneventful 6 months, but he held it for 6 months. And then, of course, they did him dirty with the way he lost it. But that's really all it was going to be. It was about the moment. And it's the same thing I feel with Jey Uso. It's about the moment. And now it's just a matter of when. How soon do they take that title off of him and put it most likely on Seth Rollins? I give it until SummerSlam at the absolute latest. I'm not even sure he'll make it there. I feel like Backlash would be too soon. But he's not going to have that title for very long. The Jey Uso story arc, though, from 5 years ago to now, has been pretty fun to see. Because you remember those empty arena shows they were doing when the Bloodline story really began. And it was all about, you know, Jimmy Uso. He got hurt at WrestleMania 36, wrestling in that empty building, and he tore his ACL. And so many times with these tag teams, one guy gets hurt, the other guy's fucked. The other guy's just sitting on the shelf until his partner is ready to come back. And in this case, and I'm sure, you know, Jay being part of that family, you know, Roman, and, you know, he had family going to bat for him. Not everybody has that. But they kept him on TV, and they incorporated him into this Bloodline story. And that's where we first got to see this character development in Jey Uso, which is something I never expected because I never saw Jey Uso doing more than what he was doing. But to go from that to where he is now, winning a world championship at WrestleMania 5 years later, is pretty cool stuff. You know, whatever you think of him as a wrestler. And if Jimmy doesn't tear his ACL at WrestleMania that year, I don't think any of this happens. But we had three title changes. That was one. The other one was The New Day beating the War Raiders to win the World Tag Team titles. A very, you know, very basic match. Really nothing out of the ordinary about it. Nothing overly special about it. The other tag team title match, they're doing that on TV on Friday. They're doing a TLC match for the WWE Tag Team titles. That did not get the WrestleMania treatment. That is going to be on SmackDown this Friday. This match was chosen for the WrestleMania card instead. It was what it was. Jacob Fatu, the new United States champion with a win over LA Knight. They had the second best match, I thought, on the entire show. The first of many titles to come for Jacob. And then there was Charlotte and Tiffany. Charlotte Flair and Tiffany Stratton for the WWE Women's Championship. I was very curious to see how these two would work together. And there's going to be a lot of differing opinions on this match of whether or not Charlotte was taking liberties with Tiffany. Tiffany was taking liberties with Charlotte. One thing I will say is when this match was over, Tiffany more than Charlotte looked like she was in a fight. She had a bruise on her forehead. It looked like she may have chipped a few teeth. Apparently her teeth were fine. I guess maybe it was lipstick that rubbed off on her teeth, but she just, when they put her on camera, she just looked like, okay, this woman was in a real struggle here in this match, but she won. And Tiffany Stratton is still the women's champion, and she got a clean pinfall win in the middle of the ring over Charlotte Flair, which was refreshing to see, and it was the right finish. It was not the finish I was expecting at all, so it was a pleasant surprise for me. But I already see the comments that, you know, they were shooting on each other, or Charlotte was sandbagging her. I didn't get the impression that anybody was taking liberties with anybody else. They definitely worked a very snug match. It felt very gritty. I also didn't think it was all that great. I see some people saying, oh, this was the match of the night or the second match of the night after the main event. Hey, to each their own. I really didn't like this match. I think it was a good match for Tiffany as far as her being able to say that she beat Charlotte. That's a nice feather in her cap. But I was kind of bored watching the match. This is not a match that will have any replay value for me whatsoever. And whether or not this was one and done and they're going to kind of separate these two, or if this is the first in a series of matches they're going to have, we'll find out on Friday. I was not a fan of this. And they had Rey Fénix subbing for Rey Mysterio, trading one Rey for another against El Grande Americano, because Rey Mysterio got hurt on SmackDown on Friday night. Apparently he tore his groin, which sounds very painful. And so he was, you know, out and about. He was on the pre-show and everything. He was part of the AAA announcement on the pre-show set on Saturday. It's not like he's hobbling around on crutches or anything, but he was not medically cleared. So instead they put Rey Fénix in there. And so here he goes into this. Rey Fénix just debuted 2 weeks ago. He was in purgatory for months in AEW. He got his early release. That sounded like he was released from prison. He got paroled. And so he ends up in WWE. He only debuted in Chicago 2 weeks ago. And on less than 24 hours notice, he goes from not having a match at WrestleMania to being in a singles match on the WrestleMania card for the very first time. And it's very cool that both him and his brother are going to have their debut WrestleMania matches in the same year. Penta will make his debut tonight. So that's very cool. But it was on short notice because, you know, Mysterio couldn't go. Fénix and El Grande, they went out there. They had a good match. I would have that behind the main event and behind the U.S. title match. I thought this was the third best match on the show. I wish it had more time. It got barely 10 minutes, if even that. I think some of the matches got shortchanged here. This was one of them. But, you know, they had a good match for what it was. They did the plate gimmick, the metal plate under the mask. And El Grande Americano wins, which he had to. So, yeah, it's not ideal that Rey Fénix went in there and lost, but again, it's fine because Rey Fénix was not even supposed to be on the WrestleMania card. I am sure nobody is happier about the fact that he was able to get onto this card. I'm sure he feels badly for Rey Mysterio, but believe me, nobody is happier that he got his WrestleMania moment than Rey Fénix. I don't think he gives a shit that he lost this match because he wasn't even supposed to be in the match. And El Grande Americano had to win. It's part of his whole gimmick. He's using the loaded mask. Eventually, they will do a mask versus mask match, whether it's him and Fénix, whether it's him and Rey Mysterio, or Vikingo, or whoever it ends up being, and he will lose the mask. This was not the time for him to lose. So I don't have any issue with what they did here. They had to come up with a plan B. Slotting in Rey Fénix or Dragon Lee, that would have made the most sense. They decided to go with Rey Fénix. I have no issue with it. Now, tonight is night two of WrestleMania, which on paper looks like the stronger of the two nights, and I certainly hope it ends up being the better night overall. What we have here is Randy Orton is going to have an open challenge. Here's another plan B. We were supposed to get Randy Orton and Kevin Owens. Kevin Owens went down with a neck injury. I did see him. I saw him in the crowd at the Hall of Fame, so he's there. Has not had his surgery yet. Supposedly, he was getting a second opinion from another doctor that Randy Orton recommended. But he's out. And no, I don't think it's an angle and Owens is going to show it. What would even be the fucking point of that? But who is going to be the mystery opponent answering the open challenge? It doesn't look like it's going to be Nick Aldis. I feel like if it was going to be Aldis, there would have been some kind of hint towards that on Friday, and there really wasn't. It's not impossible, but I'm not expecting it. Solo Sikoa, I don't think it's going to be him. They kind of got away from that this week. So who does that leave? Aleister Black, it looks like, is going to be returning on SmackDown this Friday. We actually got a date in the latest vignette for this mystery person, whoever it is, the smoky vignettes that have been airing now for weeks. So it looks like they're saving his debut for Friday, which I think is absolutely appropriate. You know, you just wait until those post-Raw and SmackDown shows. You could debut somebody new. That's perfect. Who ends up in this spot, though? You're doing an open challenge. It needs to be somebody, either a big name, or it needs to be someone who is returning or debuting, but someone the people will know. Somebody that will get a reaction when they come out or when their music hits. And I think Rusev fits the bill. We know Rusev is back. He's back under contract. It's only a matter of how do they re-debut him. I think Rusev gets the spot. So, yeah, he will go in there and likely lose, because I don't think Randy Orton should be losing I think whoever answers this open challenge is going to lose. But I don't have an issue with Rusev losing as much as I would if it was Black. I just feel like Black has the higher ceiling. I wouldn't be beating him in his first match. If Rusev goes in there and has a competitive match and loses to Randy Orton, you know, off an RKO, who cares? Like, it's not going to kill him. It's fine. It's really not a big deal. He's my pick. I think it's going to be him. AJ Styles against Logan Paul. I've got AJ winning in that match. Then we have Liv and Raquel defending the women's tag team titles. They were supposed to defend the titles against Bayley and Lyra Valkyria, who won a gauntlet match on SmackDown last week. They survived the entire gauntlet. They wrestled like five other teams, and they won. And Bayley, they shot an angle yesterday where she was attacked by a mystery attacker backstage. She was laid out on the ground holding her shoulder, and it didn't look like she was going to be medically cleared. And by the way, it was so ridiculous the way they did this, because they cut to the back and Bayley is on the ground and Lyra shows up. Oh my God, what happened? And Adam Pearce comes in, and immediately they're talking about how, okay, you've got 24 hours to find a replacement. Like, she hasn't even been diagnosed. How do they know that Bayley can't go? No doctor has seen her yet. They've already eliminated her from this match. So she got double fucked in this angle. And so now Lyra is going into WrestleMania with no partner, and Adam Pearce has given her 24 hours to find someone. Gee, I wonder who that will be. Especially with all the talk in the last few days about Becky Lynch being on her way back soon. Gee, I wonder who it will be. The last time we saw Becky on TV, she was buddying up with Lyra Valkyria. In fact, the last time we saw Becky in a match was against Liv Morgan, when Liv beat her in the cage and then Liv was gloating that she retired Becky Lynch. Makes all the sense in the world. This is how they're going to re-debut Becky Lynch. This is how she returns. They're going to challenge for the tag team titles. As far as what they're going to do here, I didn't think that they would bring Becky back just to have her lose in this situation. But there was somebody, and I forgot who it was last night, who pitched an idea. And I actually, the more I think about it, the more, not only do I like it, but I think there's a very good chance we see it, which is that Becky returns. We come to find out that it was Becky who attacked Bayley, and Becky ends up going heel on Lyra. And then Liv and Raquel would retain the tag team titles. And what it does is it sets up a program now, an actual proper program, which is something that Lyra has not had since winning the championship for the Intercontinental title. Because I don't need to see Becky Lynch, you know, wrestling for the world title right out of the gate. But her working with Lyra, and even if she wins the Intercontinental Championship, I don't think that would be a bad idea. Put the title on somebody that has a big name, and at the end of it, she puts Lyra over in the biggest way possible. What a win that would be for Lyra. You could do a whole proper program with the two of them. I could see that happening. Now, where that leaves Bayley, I have no idea. I do feel bad for her. Now, Bayley is not hurt. This is not a cover for a real injury. Apparently, they've had this idea in mind for weeks. So I assume Bayley must have known that she was not really going to be wrestling at WrestleMania, but even so, she was announced, you know, for a WrestleMania match. I'm sure it's very shitty for her. There's no defense of it. I mean, it's a shitty situation for her. But they have their idea. We'll see how it plays out tonight. I don't know if Bayley will be there. She'll have her arm in a sling if she's not going to be on the show at all. I have no idea. But it's going to be Becky. Do they have Becky as a heel or a face? I don't know, but I like that idea about her going heel and then being revealed as the attacker. And that way, when Bayley, you know, heals up and is ready to come back, you know, she can work with Becky as well. We have Drew McIntyre and Damian Priest in a Sin City street fight. This could be a sleeper match on the show tonight. And I feel like these two are going to have something to prove going out there. It's just, you know, it's a mid-card match on the show. How happy they are about being in the spot they're in, where it kind of feels like, hey, we didn't have anything for these guys to do, so we'll just sort of put them together. You know, I don't know, but I kind of feel like they're going to have something to prove going out there. And this should be a Drew McIntyre win. Bron Breakker defends the Intercontinental Championship in a four-way match against Penta in his first WrestleMania, Dominic Mysterio, and Finn Balor. I'm going with Dirty Dom to win the title. I think he steals the pin on Balor to do it, continues their story, gets the title off Breaker without him having to be pinned. Penta, he'll be fine. I think Dominic Mysterio wins the title. Io Sky defends the Women's World Championship at a triple threat match against Rhea Ripley and Bianca Belair. I got Io walking out with the championship. She's walking in the champion. I think she's walking out the champion. I don't see Bianca Belair going to Monday Night Raw. In fact, I think Bianca is going to be thrust right back into this whole story with Naomi and Jade on SmackDown. In fact, I think Naomi will be making her presence felt in this match, and that will be part of what cost Bianca. So I fully expect to see Naomi, and Io is going to retain the championship. And in the main event, John Cena goes for number 17 in his very last WrestleMania match against Cody Rhodes. And you would think for somebody who has been in this company as long as he has and has had as many WrestleMania matches and WrestleMania main events as he has had, that he would have some more, you know, classics to his name, but he doesn't have as many as you would think. So this is his last chance to go out there at 46 or 7 or whatever he is and try to have one of the better, you know, WrestleMania matches from like a match quality standpoint that he's ever had. Because, I mean, he's had big matches before. You know, he's wrestled The Rock and, you know, he's had big WrestleMania matches, but he hasn't had that many great ones. He really hasn't. And Cena as an in-ring performer is not what he used to be. He's not. I can't remember the last truly great John Cena match that I saw. It's been many, many years. I think he's got a great opponent in there in Cody Rhodes. I think you have enough smoke and mirrors. Is The Rock going to be there? Is The Rock going to get involved? Is Seth Rollins or anybody else going to get involved? This could end up being a great match, or this could end up being a disappointment. I don't think it's going to be a disappointment, but we'll see. I remember watching his match with Austin Theory and thinking, man, that sucked. Right? So we don't know what we're going to get out of Cena at this point in a singles match. It's not a tag match. It's not a chamber match. It's not a Royal Rumble. Like, he looked fine in the Elimination Chamber, you know, but he was one of six guys. And he was either the last guy or one of the last guys out of the pod. So you can't judge that in the same way that you would judge a singles match. So this is going to be a test to see what kind of John Cena are we going to get in a big main event singles match like this. I hope it's the best John Cena that we've gotten in a long time, because I have him winning number 17, making history, and leaving as the WWE champion. There's going to be some kind of big angle they shoot at the end of this show. I would be shocked if The Rock is not there. Fucking Travis Scott may be there. I'm still trying to connect the dots and thinking that we're going to have some kind of tie-in to last night's main event with this one. There's going to be some kind of big angle they shoot here. Whatever it is, I think Cena stands tall and wins number 17. And we won't have to wait very long, because we're only a matter of hours away here as I am recording this. So I hope you will join me live on YouTube immediately after night two is over. We had upwards of 4,300 people live last night on YouTube. Let's see if we can top that tonight. And I did watch NXT Stand and Deliver. I didn't take any notes. I was doing work while I was watching it, trying to get all prepped for the show. But I did see it. I enjoyed it. I thought it was an excellent show. In fact, I think NXT Stand and Deliver, top to bottom as a show, was better than WrestleMania Night 1. That was a great main event. Oba Femi retaining the NXT Championship over Trick Williams and Javon Evans. I love the women's four-way. Stephanie Vaquer, still the NXT Women's Champion, with a win over Julia, Jada Parker, and Jordan Grace. All of whom, when the time comes, I think are going to do very well on the main roster. I think Jada Parker needs some more time and some more seasoning in NXT. But, I mean, they could call Stephanie, Julia, and Jordan up tomorrow, and they would fit right in either women's division on Raw or SmackDown, and they would kill it. So that was a great match. Ricky Saints, still the NXT North American champion, with a win over Ethan Page. I thought they had a good match. And they had a ladder match to crown a brand new NXT Women's North American champion. As ladder matches go, I thought this was a good one. Again, it's hard to differentiate yourself, because I were just so numb to seeing these types of matches and all the big spots and hoping they don't kill each other. Sol Ruka, though, was the winner. She's the new champion. Sol Ruka's awesome. That Soul Snatcher. I love that Soul Snatcher. She's another one. When the time comes, she's going to be a big, big player on that main roster. And Nathan Fraser and Axiom are no longer the NXT Tag Team Champions, losing the titles to Hank and Tank. See, this surprised me. I was not expecting a title change here. What I saw here from Hank and Tank, though, very impressive. They're a fun big man team. And they are the new Tag Team Champions. And then they had the D'Angelo family against their new Dark State group. And you had Stax turning on Tony D. I mean, whatever. I'm not fully into the whole D'Angelo family drama here. I've seen bits and pieces of it, but I'm not as invested in the story as maybe some of you are. But again, what I saw of the show, everything was at least good, if not great. And as a show, collectively, it was better than WrestleMania Night 1. Today's episode is sponsored by Hims. To all the men out there, within the sound of my voice, if you're starting to notice your hair thinning, you need to know there are lots of other men out there going through the exact same thing. And you may feel like there's nothing you can do about it, but that's because you haven't tried Hims Hair Loss Solutions. With Hims, you could avoid jumping through a bunch of flaming hoops and get access to treatment without even leaving home. You don't even have to put pants on. Hims provides you with convenient access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple, with doctor-trusted options and clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. Choose from personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatments to find what works best for you. The process is simple. It is 100% online, so there are no uncomfortable doctor visits. There's no waiting rooms. There's no sitting there feeling like you've got eyes on you. This takes all of that stress out of the process. Just answer a few questions and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to you for free. No insurance is needed, and one low price covers everything from treatments to ongoing care. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, and they can help you get your confidence back too, with visibly thicker and fuller hair. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/solomonster. That's hims.com/solomonster for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/solomonster. Results vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information. I was actually going to start the show with some big New Japan news, but then the WWE AAA news broke. But there was big New Japan news because in just the last week, we got the news that three names are headed for the exits, including one of the biggest stars in the promotion. Tetsuya Naito, Bushi, and Jeff Cobb are all leaving New Japan Pro Wrestling. Cobb was not a huge surprise because there was talk last month that he was possibly leaving. But Naito, I mean, that's a different story. Naito was a huge shock. New Japan announced on Wednesday that they were unable to come to terms on a new contract with the former five-time IWGP champion, six-time Intercontinental champion, three-time G1 Climax winner. He will continue to make appearances through their May 4th Wrestling Dontaku show in Fukuoka. Their statement reads as follows. In recent weeks, conversations have been ongoing between New Japan Pro Wrestling and Tetsuya Naito regarding Naito's future wrestling activities. As a result of those conversations, both parties have mutually agreed not to renew Naito's contract with New Japan Pro Wrestling. Both parties have arrived at this decision after careful consideration and lengthy conversation. Naito's contract ends on the best possible terms with NJPW, which joins fans in wishing him further success in any and all future endeavors. They call it a failure to reach a contract extension, while Meltzer and Sean Ross Sapp, they claim Naito's been working without a contract recently. Brian Alvarez says the impression he got was that he simply wanted a lot more money than they were willing to pay him. And Fightful Select reports that Naito had been exploring his options over the past month or so, and he is not expected to join AEW. I can't imagine WWE having any interest in him at this stage. I mean, they did in 2018, and supposedly they made him an offer that he turned down, but I mean, that was 7 years ago. And he was pretty washed even then. Now imagine him now. I mean, he's still a big name, but to their audience, you know, the WWE audience, he's not going to mean anything. You know, physically, he's just completely washed. His knees are shot. He's had the eye issues. He's had three surgeries on his right eye, and I think he's had one on his left. And he admitted to Tokyo Sports in December that people talk about his knees, but it's his eyes, you know, that are the biggest issue. I've talked about this before. He was having issues with triple vision. You know, when he looks down, he sees a flat surface and he sees a slanted one. So working in the ring, especially when he like tries to run, it's a challenge for him. You know, he can't trust his footing in there. And so he had surgery on his left eye because of the macular degeneration he has in the right one. And he could only see straight if he shut one eye because they were imbalanced. So that most recent surgery was to try to balance them out. So he had surgery to make the healthy eye worse just so the two would match up. But there are limits on the number of surgeries that he could have on the right eye, and he's already hit that limit. He can't have any more. But this is very different than when WWE brought in Shinsuke Nakamura. You know, I don't know what Naito adds if, let's say, they were to bring him in. In New Japan, he's a legend, and he sells a ton of merchandise, all that LIJ merch, which is why this is a big blow to New Japan. But if the issue was money, you know, whatever New Japan was offering him, I don't know that he's going to get that from any other Japanese promotion. Like, what other promotion is going to be able to pay him what he's looking for? Where else is there for him to go? You know, he could freelance over there if he wants to, like Minoru Suzuki does. Suzuki freelances there. He does indies over here. I saw Minoru Suzuki had a match with Yoshihiko the blow-up doll the other night. Yeah, she made the doll bleed. I didn't see how it happened, but I saw the doll had blood on it, which figures when you're in there with Suzuki. Naito could do something like that, you know? Who's to say he still doesn't work shots here and there with New Japan? Right? That's certainly possible. It doesn't have to be a permanent break. But I mean, if this was like 5, 6, 7 years ago and Naito became a free agent, he would be getting big offers to go elsewhere. Today, with his body in the shape it's in, I mean, he could work indies and make a killing. But as far as big money from a major promotion outside of Japan, I just don't know where he's going to go. You know, that match he had with Jon Moxley at Forbidden Door last year was the worst thing on the entire show. It was sad watching that. His match with Hiromu Takahashi at the Tokyo Dome this year, that was not good either. I mean, I was just bored watching it. He just can't go at a high level anymore. It's sad watching the old guard age out or leave. You know, Okada was a gigantic loss for them. Tanahashi is retiring at the Dome next year, and he's not the same performer either that he used to be. Naito's been falling apart for years. Now he's out the door. Nakamura, I mean, they lost him years ago, and Shibata. Then you have the foreign talent they've lost, Will Ospreay and Jay White. It's sad to see. And meanwhile, his fellow LIJ member, Bushi, is also finishing up with New Japan on May 4th. He's been with the company since 2012. He is said to be leaving, possibly, strictly, out of loyalty to Naito. Bushi is not a star at Naito's level, but he's been with the company for a long time, and he had been announced for the upcoming Best of the Super Juniors, which I assume now is not going to happen. Jeff Cobb is also leaving, and that news comes barely a week after he won the IWGP Tag Team titles as part of United Empire. New Japan wrote this on its website. New Japan Pro Wrestling has come to terms with the departure of Jeff Cobb at his request. With Cobb, one half of the IWGP Tag Team Champions, those titles have now been vacated. Cobb's final match in New Japan will take place in Korakuen Hall on April 19th against Hiroshi Tanahashi. New Japan Pro Wrestling profoundly apologizes for the sudden nature of this news and joins fans in wishing Cobb the best in all of his future endeavors. And he did wrestle Tanahashi yesterday and lost. So the suddenness of it clearly caught them by surprise. Although there have been reports that New Japan knew he was leaving and going to WWE even before they put the tag belts on him. They just may not have known that they were going to pull the trigger and pull him as quickly as they did. So they appeared to have been caught off guard by this. Otherwise, I don't really know why they would have put the championship on him. And supposedly he was scheduled to challenge Hirooki Goto for the IWGP title on May 4th. And that is obviously not happening now. Cobb is a very good wrestler. He has been with New Japan for many years. He lives in Japan, but he's also turning 43 in July. And he probably realized, hey, this could be my last chance to make some big money working for one of the two major promotions in the States. So he is said to be WWE bound. He worked his final match last night, so I would assume he's free and clear to appear in WWE as soon as tonight. But that doesn't mean he's going to be at WrestleMania. I don't think he's going to be at WrestleMania. Maybe the Raw after Mania or the SmackDown after Mania, assuming he goes straight to the main roster. It's very interesting that he would choose WWE over AEW, given that he has worked matches for AEW before. But it could be just as simple as, hey, you know what? This is a challenge that I would like to try. They want me. I can make good money there. I've never worked there before. I've already done this other place. Could be as simple as that. This is also, by the way, the third time in recent months that WWE has signed someone quick enough that it forced that person to have to surrender a championship that they held for another promotion. Okay, look at Stephanie Vaquer last summer. She was a double champion. She held the CMLL women's title and women's tag team title when WWE signed her, and they booked her. They booked her debut in Mexico on the same night that CMLL wanted her to drop at least one of those titles and do business on her way out. WWE, if they wanted to, they could have allowed that to happen. They don't give a shit. They don't. Not only do they not give a shit, they booked her for a show in Mexico that very same night. So instead of dropping the titles, she was stripped. Omos. I mentioned him earlier. Omos, they sent him to Japan to work for Pro Wrestling Noah. He became one half of the GHC Tag Team Champions. He was booked like a monster. He destroyed everybody he worked with. Only for WWE to call him back before he had the chance to drop the titles. So what happened? They had to be vacated. And what was so urgent that WWE needed him back? They have not used him since. I mean, by all accounts, he was enjoying his time there. I don't think it was a case where he was dying to come back. And if it was, so what? They would have had him drop the belts on the way out. But again, WWE, they don't care. They don't give a shit. Noah's not going to say anything because they're just happy that they could have any kind of working relationship with WWE. Ricky Starks, the day after the news broke that he finally got his AEW release, he showed up on NXT television. This was just after he had won the Defy Wrestling title. He ended Kenta's 626-day reign as the Defy champion. 3 weeks later, the title had to be vacated because WWE would not let him drop it. Now here we have Jeff Cobb having to vacate the IWGP tag team title. If Cobb was working without a contract, or even if he was and it was about to expire, with all the talk about him possibly leaving, then it was very stupid of New Japan to put a title on him in the first place. They kind of set themselves up for that. But again, it just illustrates how little regard WWE has for other promotions, you know, when it comes to this stuff. When it comes to doing quote unquote business, the only business they care about is their own and how it affects them. And I think it's very important when you hear about these stories or even the AAA stuff, and we don't know how that's all going to work out or what their plans are, but I think it's very important to look at that from that perspective. How can this benefit WWE? That is the number one priority that they have. And they should be concerned about how this is going to benefit their own company. But at the end of the day, that's really all they care about. Now let's talk about some AEW here, because there are some AEW news and notes I need to get to. It looks like a former AEW Women's World Champion may soon be leaving the company and headed to WWE. As in Mariah May. Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez first reported this week that Mariah, who has not worked a match since her loss to Toni Storm at Revolution, wants to go to WWE. And the belief is that her contract is up sometime this summer. Alvarez said he's of the impression that she signed a 2-year deal, and that even within AEW, the belief is that she is headed to WWE as soon as she becomes available. For his part, Mike Johnson on PW Insider said that Mariah still has significant time left on her deal, with one source believing her deal could run through November of this year, while another believes there may be additional time beyond that. And he also noted that there was a rumor making the round within days of her program with Toni Storm ending that she had requested her release from her AEW deal. But he just wasn't able to confirm the accuracy of that rumor, so he didn't run with it. And she obviously hasn't gotten her release yet, even if she did ask for it. Then there's Fightful Select, which had a report saying that even though Mariah did not make her AEW debut until November of 2023, she was actually signed in August of that year. And it was indeed a two-year deal, which means she could potentially be a free agent in less than 4 months. Unless they either reach a new deal or they extend her, I guess like an option year, because she hasn't missed any time due to injury that I'm aware of. So they couldn't tack on any injury time. You know, usually you hear about three-year deals, five-year deals with AEW, or even WWE. I mentioned before, CM Punk said that they want to sign him to a five-year contract. I wonder if Mariah asked for a two-year deal on purpose for this very reason. You know, she grew up a wrestling fan. She grew up a WWE fan. You know, back then there was no AEW. And this is one of the competitive advantages that WWE has over AEW, just their mere existence. You know, for so long, you have a lot of guys and girls who grew up wanting to be a superstar in WWE. What do you want to do when you grow up? I want to be a WWE superstar. Because that's what they watched on TV. And they want to be at WrestleMania. There's a photo of Mariah in the parking lot outside WrestleMania when the show came to Dallas. The year that Steve Austin came out of retirement to wrestle Kevin Owens. She was there. That was the year before she signed with AEW. And if it's her dream to work for WWE, and look, she knows she's going to get paid either way, then it may not matter what Tony Khan offers her. If her heart is set on going there, then that's where she's going to go. It doesn't mean that Tony shouldn't, you know, should just lay down and let her go without making an offer and give her a nice pay raise or something. But, you know, money is not the end-all be-all for some people. Look at Jade Cargill. Tony wanted to keep her. They were negotiating and she wanted a bigger offer. So what did he do? He increased his offer. He actually came up to a number that was higher than what she originally asked for. And she still left and went to WWE. There's only so much you can do. I'm sure Tony is going to make her a great offer to keep her, if he hasn't already. But if she wants to leave, then she's going to leave. Now, there's also the possibility that she's really, really smart, and she's using this to leverage a better deal. And she ends up staying in AEW. That's also possible. You know, she's only 26 years old. It's not like she isn't going to end up in WWE at some point. It doesn't have to be right now. But the fact that she hasn't been featured on TV at all in 6 weeks, and she wasn't included in the Owen Hart tournament, which she won last year, that should have been a sign that something was going on. You know, Tony has demonstrated that when someone wants out, or he thinks they want to go to WWE, he will not hesitate to pull them off television and bench them until their contract is up. He did it with Ricky Starks, he did it with Penta, he did it with Rey Fénix, and they all ended up in WWE. If he loses her, that is a big loss for that AEW women's division, because Mariah is, I think she's fantastic. She's not afraid to get down and dirty in the ring. I mean, this woman taped her fist and dipped it in glass in her last match, okay? She can do that stuff. She's not afraid to get hardcore, but she's also just a really good wrestler. She's got incredible sex appeal. She's got incredible charisma. She's a great heel. I mean, this woman slapped her own mother across the face at Wembley last year. She's part of one of the best storylines in AEW history. With Tony Storm, they played that out for months before that savage attack on Tony, one of the best Dynamite endings you'll ever see. If I'm surprised about anything, it's that her friend Mina Shirakawa, she just announced that she's leaving Japan to sign with AEW. And now Mariah may be leaving. So there'll be like two ships passing in the night. But if Mariah does go to WWE, she'll do very well. And it'll be a blow to AEW, but it's not as if they don't have a lot of other talent in that division. With Tony Storm and Mercedes and Athena and Chris Statlander and Jamie Hayter and Willow Nightingale, Megan Bain, Billy Starks, she's a star on the rise, Harley Cameron, I'd say Deonna Purrazzo, but they barely use her. So, I mean, they're going to be fine. Yeah, but Mariah is the kind of talent that you could build around in that division. There is something to be said for too much too soon. You know, less than a year after she debuted, she won the world title. Not even the TBS title. The world title. And she had the great story with Tony. After that, it's like, where is there to go, really? Everything else just feels like a lateral move. Megan Bain is another example. Only, you know, Megan Bain didn't win the title, but she got a shot at Tony pretty damn quick. So if there's a story that makes sense, then I say do it. But I do think it will give Tony Khan pause the next time somebody comes in, how quickly they get pushed to the top for fear that if you give them everything, they may feel like they have nothing left to really achieve. AEW this week announced its first ever show in Mexico. So then, of course, WWE goes and buys a Mexican promotion. You can't make this shit up. You just can't make this shit up. But they announced their first show in Mexico, and where it is taking place, is, I think, is actually very cool. They're going to be running a live episode of Dynamite from Arena Mexico, which is owned by CMLL and is one of the more legendary wrestling venues in the world. No U.S. promotion has ever run a show like this at Arena Mexico before. CMLL has rented the building out to other promotions in the past, but for a U.S. company, this is a first. It'll be AEW Grand Slam Mexico on Wednesday, June 18th. Tickets go on sale April 26th. They're not running any pay-per-views in June. It was the same thing in February. They ran Grand Slam Australia instead. And so this time it's Grand Slam Mexico. And I am sure it will include talent from CMLL, because on the poster they show Mystico and Mascara Dorada. They also show Hologram, Commander, Kenny Omega, and Will Ospreay. They also confirmed the location for this year's Forbidden Door pay-per-view on Sunday, August 24th. We already had the date, so we knew the show was taking place on the 24th in London. We just didn't know where. It will be emanating from the O2 Arena, featuring talent from AEW, New Japan, and CMLL. And the O2 was expected, but apparently because WWE already had a contract with the arena for shows last month, that was during its European tour, in the contract it stipulated that no other wrestling promotion could announce a date in the building for 2 weeks after their last show. So AEW wasn't allowed to make any announcement until this week. But with that, we also got some terrible, what I think is terrible news. AEW is running back-to-back weeks with a four-hour block of programming. Kill me now. Actually, they already announced the first four-hour block 2 weeks ago, but I missed it. But when they announced the second one this week, I noticed that there was another one scheduled for the week before. So on Wednesday, June 4th, they're going to be airing four straight hours, I assume on TBS, basically with Dynamite and Collision back-to-back from Denver, Colorado. That will be their Fyter Fest special, which would be the first one they've done in 2 years. Again, they have no pay-per-view in June. So we're getting Fyter Fest, and then we have Grand Slam Mexico 2 weeks later. But in between those two, on Wednesday, June 11th, is another four-hour block of television just announced. They're calling it Summer Blockbuster from Portland, Oregon. So another back-to-back Dynamite and Collision in the same night. The reason for this is that Collision is not going to be airing on a Saturday from May 24th to June 21st. I assume it has to do with sports programming airing on TNT. They've got the NBA and the NHL playoffs coming up. Whatever the reason, they're experimenting. And I don't like this experiment. I don't like this one bit. You know what I did like, though? I actually really liked Dynamite on Wednesday night. They had their Dynamite Spring Breakthrough show, which was one of the best episodes of AEW television that they have ever produced. It wasn't just the best Dynamite of the year. It is one of the best episodes of Dynamite that they have ever done. And it emanated from the MGM Music Hall at Fenway in Boston, which was a very cool, very intimate venue. We have new trios champions. The Death Riders have been dethroned. And in the place of Hook, who was not medically cleared, and the last we saw Hook, he was in the main event the week before, vomiting in the middle of the ring. So whether it was a concussion or something else, obviously he was not medically cleared for a reason. And so in his place, teaming with Samoa Joe and Katsuyori Shibata, was Powerhouse Hobbs, who is now, I guess, he's the newest member of the Ops, because he is now one-third of the Trios champions. And they did this finish in a way, it was very much, and I said this in the review on Wednesday, it was very much patterned after Lex Luger beating Hollywood Hogan on the 100th episode of Nitro. This, by the way, was a milestone episode for them, just like Nitro was that night. This was the 289th episode of Dynamite, which officially surpassed WCW Monday Nitro's 288 episodes. But on that 100th episode of Nitro back in 97, Luger submitted Hogan with the torture rack and won the championship. It's one of the all-time great moments on Nitro. And the, I mean, the place just erupted. I think they were in Detroit. The roster came out to celebrate with him. And finally, someone had gotten one over on the NWO, even though we all knew the direction was still Hogan against Sting. So a lot of people probably weren't expecting there to be a title change on that show, but it was just this great celebratory moment, right? And like here, we know the ultimate direction here is not Samoa Joe and John Moxley in Texas at All In, but you could absolutely do that match at Double or Nothing. You could do that match on TV between now and then with Joe as sort of a lame duck challenger. That's what it felt like to me when the show was over. And then on Collision, the next night, they had a live Thursday Collision in the same venue. Moxley challenged Joe to a match. The champion issued the challenge to the challenger, which at least here makes sense since Moxley is pissed off and embarrassed that he got, not only did he get beaten by this man, he got submitted. Joe put him to sleep. That's how they won the trios titles. So now he wants to get Joe back in the ring, and he said he would even put the AEW world title on the line. So when this match happens, it will only be the second match these two have ever had. The only other match they had was on Raw back in 2017, and that was a match that Joe won. There's so much time, though, between now and Double or Nothing. I could see this being a television match, and then Moxley ends up being a part of Anarchy in the Arena at the pay-per-view instead. And maybe Joe, too. Maybe Joe will be on the babyface team. But they're definitely having a championship match. We just don't have a date on that yet. But the way they structured that main event and everything, it was very well done. And they had the roster, just like Nitro in 97. They had members of the roster come out, and they were popping bottles and celebrating. And Joe did a promo when the show went off the air. And so it was this great moment for the people in the venue. If they wanted to turn Hook heel, right? Because I'm thinking about Hook now. And we don't know when Hook is going to be back. He could be back this week. If they wanted to turn Hook heel out of this, him being the one to cost Joe after feeling betrayed by Hobbs taking his spot, that could be one way to go. Or Hook could just simply come back, and now they have four members of the ops instead of three. But I'm just saying, if they wanted to turn him heel out of this, that would be, I think, the way to do it. They also had a bunch of Owen Hart Foundation tournament matches. And we had, for the very first time, Mercedes Moné and Athena one-on-one. And they had an excellent match. I did not realize until later, I didn't mention it during the review because I just didn't realize it, that they took that finish, that roll-up finish that they did right out of the match where Owen Hart pinned The Rock to win his first Intercontinental title. Or at least it wasn't exact, but it was a very similar finish. And I'm sure that wasn't unintentional, given this is the Owen Hart tournament. So that was very cool. But this is one of the best matches Mercedes has had yet in AEW. I don't know if I would rank it above her last match with Chris Statlander, but it's up there as one of the best matches that she's had. So even in their first match where you know they weren't giving everything away, they still went out there and had a great match, which is why I hope they turn this into a series with at least one more match, if not two more matches, because I know they got even better matches in them. I know there's a story there to tell. Instead, when the match was over, they were teasing that Mercedes would be wrestling Toni Storm. Toni Storm was up in the crowd. They were looking at each other, very heavily teasing that match because the winner of this tournament will challenge Toni for the title in Texas. Toni for the title in Texas. That's a lot of tease. But that's what they're going to be doing it all in. And they may have teased it, but I'm still hopeful that's not what they're going to do. I just don't think that's the right move to make. I think the right move to make would be to run things back with Mercedes and Athena, and you could save Toni for someone else, like a Jamie Hayter. I would have Jamie Hayter win this tournament and set that match up for Texas, and there's history there between those two. Maybe Athena gets involved in the finals and costs Mercedes the cup. I mean, it's possible. I didn't really catch it right away. Mercedes grabbing her tights on the roll-up at the end of their match. It almost looked like she was just grabbing her ass to me. I didn't necessarily look at it as, oh, she's got the tights. Because when the match was over, the announcers didn't even mention it. They didn't even really focus on it like she cheated or anything. They just quickly pivoted to Toni Storm in the crowd, and they really didn't say anything about it. But, I mean, I suppose Athena could have an issue with how that all went down and could end up getting involved. We had Will Ospreay and Konosuke Takeshita on the men's side of things, and they absolutely tore the house down. They found a way somehow to top their match from Revolution last year, which was one of the best matches all year. These two went out there. They just fucking killed it. It was great. Ospreay advances. He goes to the finals. We had the debut of Josh Alexander. He was the wild card against Hangman Adam Page. He lost, even though it was his first match. But what I do like is that he joined the Don Callis family. And I just think that's going to be a good move for him. Ospreay against Hangman in the finals. I think that's the way it's shaping up. I could see Hangman being involved in Anarchy in the Arena, though, at Double or Nothing. And they run back Ospreay and Fletcher on that show instead in the finals one more time. But what good would it do for Fletcher to just go out there and lose again to Ospreay? Also, with Ospreay against Hangman, you have the drama of not being sure who's winning. Because I could plausibly see either man challenging for the title in Texas. I still think it's going to be Will Ospreay. But you can make an argument that Hangman wins and the cowboy rolls into Texas to challenge for the championship and try to be the savior of the entire company. It could go either way. I think Ospreay wins, though. And we get Swerve and Hangman in a tag team against the Young Bucks. But there's just more drama and unpredictability if it's Ospreay against Hangman than there is if we get Ospreay against Fletcher again. And the Hurt Syndicate, they had a tag team title defense on the show against the Gates of Agony. We had a segment with them and MJF, who continues to court them and is trying to become a member of the Hurt Syndicate. Is this leading to a Pinnacle reunion? Or actually, somebody suggested a Dynasty reunion from the MLW days with Richard Holiday and Alexander Hammerstone. Thing is, Hammerstone recently returned to MLW, so I'm not sure how likely that is. His contract with TNA ended a couple of months ago. He went right back to MLW. I mean, I guess that doesn't mean he signed there. He could be on a per-appearance deal. But ultimately, I don't know where this is going. It feels to me like MJF is going to end up with his own group to go up against the Hurt Syndicate. It's been an interesting story. I don't know where it's going, but I like the element that Bobby Lashley just doesn't trust this guy at all. And it's MVP who's trying to talk him into it. Like, look, I agree with you, but if there's anything amiss, then we'll put a beating on him. And so Lashley now is starting to warm up to it. But that's what happens, right? He starts to warm up to it, and that's when he gets fucked over. And then we end up with whatever the feud is going to be. But from top to bottom, again, this was an excellent episode of Dynamite. It was better than any of the WWE TV shows this week. Dynamite was a clear and easy number one. And if we get more Dynamites like that, if we can get shows like that on a more consistent basis, and if they're fortunate enough to end up in front of a crowd like the one we had on Wednesday, you know, people talk about restoring the feeling with Dynamite. That would go a long way towards restoring that feeling. I mean, not every week can be a Grand Slam home run, but I would like to see more shows like that because that show is fucking great. All right, so again, tonight is WrestleMania Night 2, and I'm going to be live on YouTube with the full recap talking about the entire show and all the happenings and what goes down in the main event. I hope you'll be able to join me. We had a late night last night, but it was a fun night. Again, we had upwards of 4,300 people at the peak. Hopefully we can top that tonight. I will be back with you live tomorrow night as well for the Raw post show, the big Raw after WrestleMania, and for Dynamite on Wednesday. There will be no SmackDown review this Friday. More importantly, there will be no podcast next Sunday. So expect to get a new podcast episode 9/11 in 2 weeks because I will be away in Chicago next weekend. If anything changes on that front, I will be sure to let you guys know on X. What I'm going to do right now is I'm going to include my WrestleMania 9 documentary review, which went up on YouTube several days ago, but I wanted to include it here as well. I know a lot of people wanted to know my thoughts on the documentary. They enjoyed the documentary. I did too, but I did have a lot to say about it. And so right now we're going to end this week's show with my full review, The Making of WrestleMania 9. And I will see you live tonight on YouTube for Night 2 of the WrestleMania review. When I heard that WWE was releasing a documentary on WrestleMania 9, I geeked out because this is the kind of stuff that speaks to me. This is the kind of thing I wanted out of the WWE Network when it launched. A lot of people call WrestleMania 9 the worst, or one of the worst of all time. 11 is the worst. 27 was bad. 29 was abysmal, outside of the Undertaker-CM Punk match. 9 is among the worst for sure, but I can't call it the worst. It's got a certain charm to it, even though most of the matches sucked. It didn't feel like a WrestleMania, but it's got its own unique identity that no other WrestleMania has outside of, I guess, the empty arena one they were forced to do for 36. Peacock dropped a nearly two-hour documentary called WrestleMania 9, Becoming a Spectacle. And I really enjoyed it. For all of the unseen footage, mostly, you know, more than anything else, we even got a shot of a young Nick Khan, who now runs the entire company. He was working for Caesars as an usher for the show. And I know he's talked about it before, but I've never actually seen a freeze frame of him working the show, but there he was. They had a camera following people around in the days leading up to the show as they constructed a small arena, really, is what they did, in the parking lot of Caesars Palace. That's where they did WrestleMania 9, in the parking lot. And these 30 tapes have been sitting in their vault since 1993. A vault that has over 575,000 hours of footage. Like, my God, the fun I could have spending a week in that vault, just going through just random tapes. But the real stars of the show aren't even the talent so much. It's all of the crew and the production members responsible for putting on the show. These are sort of the unsung heroes of WWE who don't get the credit. Like, literally, they didn't even get any on-screen credits back then, the way, you know, Paul Levesque and Lee Fitting do now at the end of every Raw and SmackDown episode. They're the ones who made everything happen and brought that show to life, and we get the chance to hear from them and see them in action and in the planning stages of the show, which is fascinating to watch. I also love that George and Adam still work for WWE after all these years. If you were watching WWE television in the, I'd say, mid-90s, George and Adam were the two, like, obsessed WWE superfans that they would show sometimes. They would feature them in commercials. I think they even presented at the Slammy Awards once. They weren't paid actors. They actually worked for the company. It was either on the production end or their home video department. I know Adam at one point was responsible for some of the promo packages that we would see because Shawn Michaels thanked him by name once for always making him look good. George Germanakos and Adam Panucci. George is featured in this documentary right from the get-go. He's the one playing the tapes. He's the one sitting in the archives playing the tapes for us and giving us a little intro before each one to let us know what we're about to see. He works in the archives for WWE. He's got the best job. Adam Panucci is not featured in this documentary, but when I saw George, I immediately thought of Adam, who is currently their head of global production. You know, 93 is an interesting time. Business was in the shitter, really, for both companies that year, WWE and WCW. It was really 92 and 93, but there was a lot of good stuff from those years. You know, even in WCW, Vader as the champion, his matches with Sting. They had that great War Games match of Wrestle War with Sting Squadron against the Dangerous Alliance, which I still say is the greatest War Games match of all time. Rick Rude, after he left WWE, had a really good run there. And then you look at WWE, you know, 92 is Ric Flair's first full year, really his only full year during that initial run. We got the greatest Royal Rumble of all time. I really liked WrestleMania 8. It's one of my favorite manias. You had SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium, 80,000 fans. They couldn't do that kind of business in the States, but they were still very popular overseas. You know, the buildings were not full during that period. It was the land of 1,000 gimmicks. Everybody had to have a gimmick. And it felt like they were in a period of transition, especially from 92 into 93. And a lot of that was out of necessity. You know, Vince McMahon had the federal government breathing down his neck, the steroid stuff. A lot of those giant physiques magically started to shrink, or people just disappeared altogether. The era of Hulkamania was over. It felt like it was over. And they were ushering in a new era with guys like Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, and they brought in Razor Ramon and Tatanka. It just felt different. And that's the thing about this documentary. It feels like they're stuck between these two eras, and they're not quite sure yet what they want to be. Because for all the new faces, by the time WrestleMania is over, they're back to the oldest face of all. And it feels like they're taking a step backwards when they were trying to move forward. But there are times watching this where they go way over the top talking about the significance of WrestleMania 9. You know, how without WrestleMania 9, Mania as it is today doesn't exist, which is completely laughable. If WrestleMania 9 never happened, WrestleMania exists today exactly the way that it does, with all the bells and whistles and pageantry and everything that comes with it. What it was the first WrestleMania they did that had a specific theme. You know, they billed it as the world's largest toga party. So they created this venue and they kind of did it up like something out of ancient Roman times. They had Caesar and Cleopatra, they had elephants and they had vultures and all kinds of animals. It was the first WrestleMania with a custom set. That is true. A lot of the WrestleManias that came before it had much bigger crowds because they hosted it in much larger venues. You know, WrestleMania 3, WrestleMania 6, WrestleMania 8, even the year before. But for the most part, they all looked the same. I mean, the ones from Trump Plaza, they had a different look to them because that was a very unique venue. But a lot of the other WrestleManias, they all just looked the same. WrestleMania 8 the year before had 60,000 people in the Hoosier Dome, even though it was heavily papered. I mean, a lot of those 60,000 didn't pay to get in. A lot of freebies given out. But as for the look and the feel of the show, it was very bland. You know, this was something unique that they created from scratch, and you could tell they had a lot of fun making it. Vince McMahon is featured a good amount. Not new footage, obviously, but just you can't avoid it. You know, you can't really do a documentary like this and show all this old footage without using the footage with him in it. He was obviously intimately involved in the planning of the show. But I do wonder if not having access to him today played a part in how little time they spent on what I was looking forward to the most and what I thought would be the most interesting part of the entire documentary, which was the decision to go with Hulk Hogan at the very end, getting the surprise win over Yokozuna and transitioning the title over from Bret Hart to Yoko to Hulk. They covered it. They didn't avoid it. I mean, they covered it, but they avoided any real discussion about what went into the decision. You know, ultimately, it was Vince McMahon's decision. You know, Bret has said certain promises were made to him and he was backstabbed. You know, that's his story. Hogan has his version of events, which it's Hogan. So right off the bat, I've been conditioned to not believe anything the man says. Because they didn't have Vince sit down for this, we couldn't get his perspective on what went into the decision. Like, of all the people, all the talking heads in this documentary, you've got Bruce Pritchard, and you've got Basil DeVito, and you've got all these people, these current and former WWE executives and people directly involved in the planning of this show. And it was great that they were able to get their perspective. But the number one guy, you know, if he even remembers a lot of this stuff, I mean, who the hell knows? He's almost 80 years old now, but would have been Vince, right? Because this was Vince's show. And so he would have known why we did this and why we did that. Obviously, they were never going to get him to sit down for an interview for this for obvious reasons. But we were missing that perspective. You know, as far as what went into that decision. How far back was the decision actually made? Was there ever really a plan in place to do Bret Hart against Hulk Hogan at SummerSlam in 93? Because there's been a lot of conflicting stories on that, you know, over the years. It was disappointing that they didn't dive deeper into that. Instead, we get kind of like bits and pieces from different people to basically say it came down to business, which I'm sure it did. I mean, at the end of the day, that's really what it comes down to. So, I mean, we could kind of piece it together ourselves. You know, was it simply a case of Vince falling back on his tried and true to try to give the business a jolt? Was it Hogan playing politics to get the belt back or else he wouldn't work the show? You have Undertaker in this saying there was a lot of politicking going on behind the scenes, but we don't get any further discussion about it. You know, is that something he was aware of or is that something he heard? Like, we don't know. The other thing they focus a lot on is Hogan's black eye that he showed up sporting the day of the show and how he got that black eye. Now, Hogan claims it was a jet ski accident. The urban legend has always been that he got punched in the face by the Macho Man Randy Savage. Savage and Hogan were not friendly during this time period. Savage's marriage to Elizabeth had fallen apart the year before, and he blamed Hogan and his wife for it. Yeah, because they would invite Liz to come stay with them when she wanted to get away from Randy. who is an insanely jealous husband. I don't know the inner workings of their marriage, but you hear enough stories. And look, I love the Macho Man, but the guy was a lunatic. You know, he would lock her in the dressing room at shows when he had to go do something to make sure that she couldn't leave. And none of the other wrestlers could talk to her. Like, this isn't normal behavior. There was nothing normal about Randy Savage. Whatever her reasons were, Liz would leave, and she would go spend days at a time with Hulk and his wife Linda, and wouldn't tell Randy, you know, where she was going, and he wouldn't know where she was. You take someone who's paranoid as it is, and I'm sure it's enough to drive them even crazier. You know, Hogan told a story once, and it's Hogan, so, again, take it for what it's worth. But it would have been around the time of this show. Maybe a little before. And she went down to Miami with Hulk and his wife. I don't know if they were staying at a resort or where they were. Phoned Randy, Liz did, and told him to get a lawyer because she wanted a divorce. And he panicked, and he flew to Miami to go find her, only as Hogan tells it, the hotel they were staying at, he had seen Liz go into her room earlier with another man, a producer guy that Hogan was friends with. Savage shows up looking for her, and you can imagine his reaction when he knocks on her door and the producer opens the door. Long story short, you can see why Savage would have blamed Hogan for manipulating his wife into thinking that she could do better and that she should leave Randy. Now, is it plausible that he would have punched Hogan in the eye? Sure, absolutely it's plausible. The guy was fucking crazy. And he didn't like Hogan. But I never really bought the story that Savage did it. Like, even if you believe that Savage did it, and Hogan maybe kept it a secret from Vince, right, and concocted the jet ski story not to get Randy in any trouble, you know, boys will be boys, don't be a snitch, that sort of thing. There's footage, and they didn't show it in the documentary, I thought they would, but there is footage of when WrestleMania 9 went off the air that night, of Savage climbing into the ring, because he was at ringside doing commentary, and he climbs into the ring to raise Hogan's hand. And this was after the show went off the air. This is not something that aired on TV. This is, you know, Vince, I want you to go in the ring, and I want you to celebrate with... This was Randy just going into the ring, and he's raising Hogan's arm, and he's celebrating with him. I just can't imagine Savage doing that if he was so angry with Hogan that he would punch the guy in the face. I mean, he wouldn't want to be within 10 feet of this guy. And if Vince did know what happened, he did know the real story, I can't imagine Hogan not telling Vince when he got to the venue, hey, I'm not going out there if he's out there. You know, I want him off commentary for my match. It's not like Hogan wouldn't have had the stroke to make it happen. I mean, in the documentary, Scott Steiner is one of the people interviewed because he wrestled on the show. And Scott Steiner said, well, you know, I didn't see it myself, so I can't say for sure, but he claimed Randy told him that he did it. He punched Hogan. You got Matt Bourne, Doink the Clown, has said that Randy did it. But Matt Bourne also said that Doink was going to be Hulk Hogan's original opponent for WrestleMania 9. So Matt Bourne may not be the most reliable source on this. Somebody asked Eric Bischoff the other day on Twitter about the story, the whole jet ski story. And Bischoff said that it was definitely a jet ski accident because he was negotiating with Hogan at the time when it happened. And that he heard immediate firsthand accounts from people who were involved. Now, no one is more in love with Hulk Hogan than Hulk Hogan himself. But a close number two would be Eric Bischoff. Bischoff, on his own podcast 2 years ago, said that he first became executive producer for WCW in either February or March of 93, okay, just before WrestleMania 9. And he said, and this was 2 years ago, he said that it wasn't until 94 that he started talking to Hulk Hogan. Now he claims he was negotiating with Hogan in 93, right before WrestleMania. I don't believe him. I don't believe that man. That timeline makes no sense. What do I think happened? I mean, hell if I know. I mean, I've never been in the camp of, oh, Savage definitely punched him. I feel like it's a myth that's taken on a life of its own over the years. Hogan did claim that his eye was so bad he would never be cleared by the doctor to wrestle because Nevada was a commission state. So he lied to the doctor that day by telling him that Savage had punched him as part of a storyline that they were starting and that it was all just makeup. And the doctor rolled with it and he signed off on the physical. So Hulk was able to wrestle that night. I wonder if it's a case where he really did tell that story to the doctor and maybe some other people. And over time, it just became accepted as, you know, Savage punched him for real. I don't know. And we're never going to know. None of the people involved in this are trustworthy. Savage himself obviously is dead. You're not going to get Vince to talk about this, right? They weren't going to interview him. So, and everybody else involved here, again, I don't trust a word out of their mouth. But I would like to believe that Randy Savage really did haul off and punch him in the face. I like that story better than the jet ski accident. Like, even the way Hogan describes the accident here in this documentary, it just sounds so phony. Like, he pushed the wrong button, and he got thrown over the jet ski, and then it came down and hit him in the eye. Like, he'd be fucking dead if that happened, okay? He was knocked out. He was floating unconscious in the water. But when he came to, he told Jimmy Hart, "I'm not missing WrestleMania, brother." Because he's from the old school and you make your towns. You don't miss your shots. Give me a break. One thing I like that they did is when they interview these people, they interviewed a lot of stars in this, you know, most of whom were involved in the actual show. So Hogan, Bret Hart, Undertaker, Lex Luger, Shawn Michaels. They had an iPad and they would be showing them clips that they had never seen before and then getting them to comment on it. So that was cool. I like that. You know, kind of to see their reaction in real time to this stuff. They interviewed Colin Cowherd for this documentary. Like, what the fuck? That was my reaction. As soon as I saw him on screen, I'm like, why is this guy being interviewed for this? And then I see that he used to work as a sports director at a TV station in Las Vegas. So I guess there's the Vegas connection. That's why. Colin Cowherd, the guy who once called all wrestling fans booger-eating nerds on his show. You notice when WWE got back in bed with Fox a few years ago, and he works for Fox, all of a sudden, he changed his tune. You ever notice that? He became a big wrestling fan. It's funny how that works, isn't it? Anyway, he offered nothing of value in this documentary. We got to see floor plans for the show. Again, this is one of the cool elements to this. I love seeing stuff like that. Their goal was to do a $1 million gate, which they did, with a top ticket price, get this, of $250, all the way down to $25. They said it was very important to keep that $25 price point so that people still felt like they could attend the show. That's what's lost with WWE today. Like, for $250, you might be able to get a seat up in the nosebleeds. Like, and that's by the time they add all the taxes and fees. They have completely priced people out of going to their shows, especially if you have a family. If you have a kid, if you have two kids, forget about it. You know, obviously some people can afford it. I mean, a lot of people can afford it, but some people look at it and go, I'm not going to spend my money on this. Like, you just get to a point where it's like, it's not even worth it. It's just very difficult. And they can get away with it because the product is hot and they can still sell those tickets. So long as people are willing to pay those prices, they have no incentive to change their strategy. Hey, if people want to spend $500 for a shitty seat, then hey, you know, we're not going to stand in their way. But when I saw that top ticket price for this show, like, it really drove home just how much things have changed. And after 8 days of tickets being on sale, Basil DeVito sent a memo to Vince McMahon, letting him know that they had only sold 2,000 tickets. And he said, not bad, but not great either. And that had a lot to do with why they went back to Hulk Hogan, because Hogan was not advertised for this show. This was going to be the first WrestleMania without their biggest star. Last time we saw Hogan was WrestleMania 8, and he had to go away. They didn't talk about why he had to go away. They talked about, oh, he's making TV shows and movies. And okay, sure, yeah, that's true, but they didn't really get into why he had to go away. There was a lot of heat on Hogan with the steroid stuff. And it was just a bad look. And it was agreed upon that it would be best for all involved probably to just let things cool down a little bit. Hogan's going to go off and do his own thing. which is what happened. And so he hadn't been seen for a very long time. They were off to a very slow start. And so what do you do in that situation, right? You go back to your tried and true. I loved all the footage of them setting up their little Roman Colosseum. It's pretty wild to think that there was a WrestleMania held in a parking lot. Like the first indie mud show WrestleMania. It was WrestleMania 9. They talked about Bret Hart against Yokozuna being the WrestleMania main event and how they were unproven in that spot. And there were concerns about that. Yes, that's why you go with Bret Hart defending against Randy Savage. Savage had just won the world title the previous WrestleMania. Now he's sitting at ringside doing commentary. Why not have Savage in there? He's been to the dance before. If you're worried about these guys being unproven in the main event, Savage has been to the main event a few times before. Have him put Bret over in a passing of the torch moment to give Bret some more credibility, right? Beating one of the big stars of the WrestleMania era. Like, it was right there. How do you not have Randy Savage in a match on this show? Main event or not, like, how do you not have him in a match on this show? Especially when you're trying to sell tickets. But business is business, and the call was made to go back to Hogan. They had 16,000 seats to fill. Hogan was still a name, and a name that had been gone for a while. So they can make money off the return, right? The return of the Hulkster. The other side to that is that you have a roster of full-time guys and new talent that are trying to get over. And here they're bringing back someone from the past. That's exactly what The Undertaker said in this. And that's pretty rich coming from him of all people. The guy who the last 7 or 8 years of his career was built around coming back once a year for WrestleMania. Like, my eyes rolled back in my head almost as far as his used to. There was a part where they show Howard Finkel in the ring during rehearsals as Finkus Maximus. And someone off camera shouts, "Hey, Howard, pizza, pizza." And I laughed my ass off. Like that was the funniest part of the whole documentary for me. Like, I got the reference. You have to be a certain age to get it, but I got it immediately. Because they used to have commercials for Little Caesars with the little mascot guy that would go pizza, pizza at the end of every commercial. I don't know why. I probably laughed more than I should have, but to me that was the funniest part of the whole documentary. Watching the camera crew walk around filming guys, and yeah, that was cool to see The Undertaker just shooting them a death glare. Like, what the hell is this for? Yeah, because he was so protective of the gimmick for so long, especially back then. It's weird to see Grey Glove Undertaker out of character like that. They had footage of his entrance rehearsal with the giant vulture. He said that it's all he was thinking about. This bird's going to shit on me. Is this bird going to shit on me? He was not thrilled about this. Like, imagine the bird shitting on him during the show, and there's just nothing he could do. Like, he would have to no-sell it. And there it is, just, like, dripping down his shoulder. But they also had the brilliant idea to carry Yokozuna to the ring, and they very quickly realized that this is not going to work. So they scratched that idea. They showed clips of the dark match the day of the show. It was Tito Santana against Papa Shango. Papa Shango, he was thrilled about, you know, just being on the show because Godfather lived in Vegas. So he was just happy to get a match and his friends and family were there. You know, if you count that match, even though it didn't air on TV, if you count it, Hogan is not the only one who worked the first 9 WrestleManias. So did Tito. Jim Ross made his debut on this night. He had to wear a toga. Hell of a first impression here. We had Bobby Heenan riding a camel backwards to the ring where Bruce Pritchard is talking about it. He says that was Bobby's idea because Bobby thought it would be funnier. And then they went kind of match by match. We had some highlights and they talked about the matches on the show. What they didn't mention is that Bam Bam Bigelow and Kamala were supposed to have a match on this show, but it got bumped for time. Shawn Michaels defended the Intercontinental title against Tatanka. And they didn't focus on Luna Vachon and Sensational Sherry's involvement in this match. This was the last Mania that Sherry ever worked. I have this as the best match on that show, even with the disappointing shitty finish that we got. They did a count-out finish here. The best match on this show on any other WrestleMania would be right in the middle. But on this show, it was the best match. The second best match is the tag team title match. It was the Head Shrinkers and the Steiner brothers. They didn't show the spot where Scott Steiner almost died. I think the spot was supposed to be a stun gun, but he went flying too far and the top rope got pulled down. And man, I mean, he took a header out to the floor. He is a very lucky guy because you can't see how he lands. The camera's not on that side. You just see him go over at an angle that looked like he was about to spike himself into the floor. How he didn't get hurt, I'll never know. But the Rick Steiner power slam spot off of Fatu's shoulders to Samu, that was cool. Razor Ramon and Bob Backlund, they had a nothing match. Crush against Doink. I mean, I maintain Evil Doink, one of the greatest gimmicks they've ever done. The double Doink finish was very clever. It was the only good thing about this match. Hogan and Beefcake against Money Inc. for the tag team titles. They dubbed this one half of the double main event. Because if Hogan's on the show, he's the main event. And if he can't be in the main event, then you got to make it a double main event. Actually, that's what they did the year before, too. WrestleMania 8 had a double main event. Hogan actually closed the show, and it wasn't the title match, but they were billing it as potentially his retirement match. So, I mean, when you have a star as big as Hogan, if it's possibly his last match, then, you know, I understand it. But this was the second year in a row with this double main event stuff. And Brutus says the goal was just to get through the match without dying. Hogan had his eye. Brutus had his broken face. This had another lame finish with Money Inc. retaining by disqualification. This was an issue up and down the card. All the bad finishes. I mean, there were so many bad ones. They head to the back after the match is over. And Jimmy Hart, who was also interviewed for this, says that Hogan gave him a heads up. Said, I might be doing something else tonight too. Gee, I wonder what that could be. They had Lex Luger against Mr. Perfect, who could barely speak straight in his promo before the match. He was tripping all over his words. Lex says Kurt must have been over-caffeinated that day. Yeah, that or he was on something. Because once the bell rang, he grabbed Lex in a headlock and he asked him, what are we doing? Like, he forgot the entire match. He had no idea what they were supposed to do. So Luger had to be the ringleader and lead him through the match. And it was not a great match. But they got through it. It was okay. It was not at the caliber of what you would hope a Mr. Perfect match would be. Then there was The Undertaker against the Giant Gonzalez. My God. One of the worst matches in WrestleMania history. And yet another shitty DQ finish, just so they could run it back at SummerSlam and have another shitty match. And that's all I have to say about that. The less said about that match, the better. Undertaker did what he could, but, I mean, there's only so much you can do. And then came the other half of the double main event. Bret the Hitman Hart, in his first WrestleMania main event, defending the title against Yokozuna. I like this more than I like their WrestleMania 10 match. I think that this is the superior of the two matches. Bret in the past has blamed Yokozuna for cutting out or forgetting a bunch of stuff they were supposed to do late in the match. Basically all of Bret's big comeback spots, he was pissed at Yoko for it. Like even here in the documentary, he said it was Yoko getting tired and, you know, they hit the ending sooner than Bret wanted them to. Even Mr. Fuji, like when Bret has Yokozuna in the sharpshooter, Fuji wasn't ready with the salt yet. So Bret felt like he was holding him there forever, just waiting for Fuji to pull out the salt and throw it in his eyes. Bruce Pritchard on his podcast years ago said that Vince McMahon made the call mid-match to cut their time, and it was communicated to the referee while they were in the ring wrestling because they were very worried about running out of time. Like if you weren't off the air, I think it was like 5 minutes before the top of the hour, the pay-per-view companies would just cut you off and the fans wouldn't be able to see the finish. I don't know if Bret knew that because he still blames Yoko for the finish being rushed. But he gets hit with the salt, Yoko pins Bret, and he wins the title. And here comes Hulk Hogan to cash in his money in the bank. And how do they get there? They get there with Mr. Fuji challenging Hogan to get in the ring and wrestle Yokozuna. The champion, after a hard-fought match, wins the title and then issues a challenge to the challenger to get in the ring and fight him for the championship. Yoko should have dumped Fuji right then and there, like a bad habit for doing that. And it all sounds so stupid, but you can't say the fans in the building didn't buy into it because they went crazy for the finish. It was still Hulk Hogan. Back after a year away, right, giving them the happy ending they weren't going to get if they would have just gone off the air with the evil foreigner, you know, stealing the title from the not-so-evil foreigner. This is the finish that would put a smile on everybody's face, right? And I also wonder, you know, they were in Vegas, and tickets were not selling great initially when they were advertising all the other stars on the show. Once they advertised that Hogan was coming back and Hogan was going to be there, obviously tickets started selling a lot quicker. I do wonder what the percentage was of people in the building or in the little makeshift stadium there of actual like regular WWF fans or like hardcore WWF fans and people who were either casual at best or not even wrestling fans so much as they were in Vegas and they were looking for something to do. And they saw that Hulk Hogan was going to be there and they bought tickets. Like there has to be a decent number of people that are in the stadium that night who really aren't big WWF fans. And they probably didn't even know who some of these guys were, but everybody would have known who Hogan was. So I'm sure there was a little bit of that going on too. But yeah, I'll tell you as a kid, you know, and I wasn't super duper young at that point, but as a kid, it was an exciting finish. It was. Was it a dumb way to get the belt onto him? Yes, it was. You know, both of those things can be true. It was an exciting moment, and it was very dumb. Hogan said he got a lot of heat for it. He said Savage was pissed. And Savage said, why don't you give him the tag belts, too? Why don't you give him the whole show? You know what? I'm surprised he didn't get the tag belts that night. He could have been a double champion. But then that just means he has to do two jobs instead of one to drop them all. Luger says there were some eyebrows raised in the back by that finish. Shawn Michaels says they felt they were moving to a new generation and Bret was very upset that day. He let them all know that he was very upset and they were all in agreement with Bret. Undertaker says he sees both sides. He sees the drawing power of Hogan, but he also sees the side of the guys who are working to be the next Hulk Hogan. And Bret said it went against everything Vince had told him up to that day. Vince told him, look, it's just a change of direction. Hogan says he pitched the idea to Vince, but he notes that Vince wanted him to pass the torch to Yokozuna, so the idea was for him to win it at WrestleMania and then drop it back to Yoko at the next pay-per-view. Now, remember that if what Hogan says is true, this was all laid out well in advance, right? Him winning the belt so that he could then drop it to Yokozuna at the King of the Ring, okay? What they did not get into here is what Bret has said happened after the match, and he talked about this in his book. Bret says in the back, Hogan came up to him and he thanked him and he told him I'm not going to forget it and that he would return the favor. And Bret says he looked him in the eye and he said, I'm going to remember that, Terry. Fast forward to the end of May, I believe. Bret says Vince McMahon calls him and tells him that he was going to get the belt back and Hogan was going to be used more as a special attraction. 10 days later, Vince tells Bret that Hogan was refusing to put him over. And he decided that Yokozuna would get the belt back instead. And Bret would work with Jerry the King Lawler at SummerSlam. Now that's a very different version of events than the one that Hogan gave. And Bret says, you know, he showed up at the King of the Ring in a very bad mood. He drew a cartoon. Because Bret's actually a very good illustrator. And he would do that back then. Like in the locker room, he would do these drawings and, you know, leave them up sometimes. So he got to the building and he drew a cartoon of Brutus Beefcake with his face buried in Hogan's ass cheeks with the caption, be careful, Brutus. You don't want to loosen the screws in your face. Speaking of screws. And he says he felt bad because he was taking his frustrations out on Beefcake, which wasn't the right thing to do. Hogan did an interview a number of years ago with Peter Rosenberg. And in that interview, he claimed that he made a deal to drop the belt to Yokozuna, but Vince told Bret that he was getting the belt. And when Bret confronted Hulk, Hogan says that he told Bret, look, it's not that I don't want to drop the belt to you. It's just not the deal that I made with Vince. And he says that they both met with Vince, and McMahon told Bret, this is according to Hogan now, McMahon told Bret, you getting the belt is what you thought you heard. And he said, like, oh, if Vince had asked me to drop the belt to Brett, I would have done it. You know, no questions asked. But since he asked Hogan to drop it to Yoko, Hogan felt, well, that's what had to be done. I love it. It's like it was some blood oath that he made that just could not be changed. Hogan defending against Brett at SummerSlam and then passing the torch there, that was the play. Especially if Hogan was leaving anyway. But there's no way he ever would have gone for that. Because there's always been rumors about there was a photo shoot for I think the magazine during that period. It was either in the spring or the early summer. They did a photo shoot with Brett and Hogan doing a little tug of war over the championship. I don't think it ever saw the light of day. There may have been solid plans for the two of them to work against each other at SummerSlam. That's what I mean. Like, I wish they would have dove a little bit deeper into it, talked to Bruce, talked to, I don't know, other people who may or may not have heard things at that time. Again, you can't get Vince, so it's tough. But that would have been the play. That would have been the biggest match that they could do. You know, was Brett the star of this new up-and-coming, you know, era here in the WWF, taking on the biggest star of all time and the star of the past era? But the idea that Hogan would actually go in there and do a job for a guy like Brett, like a smaller guy like Brett, there's just no way. Not back then. And it honestly would not have hurt Hogan one bit. But there's no way he ever would have agreed to that. Like, I can understand Brett being upset and feeling like he was screwed. You know, there's that word again. Brett's been screwed so many times, he should have been a light bulb. But here's the reality of the situation, okay? And I say this as a Bret Hart fan. He had every right to be upset and feel blindsided when Vince told him the night before what they were going to do. You know, you get this huge opportunity, all this pressure is, you know, put upon your shoulders, and now you just feel like a fucking failure. You know, there's like a shame to it. I wasn't good enough. That's why you're taking this away from me. But you look at every single WrestleMania before this one. Every single one of them ended with the babyface or babyfaces celebrating. It was a babyface territory. Vince's mindset was, we have to send the fans home happy at the end of the show. He didn't want Brett beating Yoko, so Yoko had to win. But then how do we give the people the happy ending, right? This is what he came up with. Then you add to that how business was doing at the time, which was not great. Like, and I don't think it's fair to lay all of this at the feet of Bret Hart just because he was the champion, but he was the champion at a time when business was down. And him on top was not doing enough to change that. Vince tried to build for the future without Hogan in 92, and it didn't work. And so he felt he needed Hogan back or else WrestleMania was going to be a dud. Like a lot of the other pay-per-views, they were not doing as well buy rate-wise as they did with Hogan on top. And he was very worried that the same thing would happen to WrestleMania. You know, they were having trouble moving tickets. Once Hogan was announced, tickets started to sell. The buy rate was low, but not as low as they expected it might be. You know, Hogan may not have been the draw that he was in 86, in 87, but he was still a draw. And he was still the biggest name in wrestling, and Vince made a business decision. You know, Brett looks at it like a personal offense to him. It wasn't. You know, it came down to dollars and cents. Like, how can we make the most money on this thing without losing our shirts? This is different from what happened in Montreal, where, you know, Brett had creative control written into his contract. And he was flat out told, like, even the day of the show, like, what the finish was going to be, and they double-crossed him. That's a very different situation. Like, Vince never told him here that he was going over at WrestleMania 9. I mean, Brett may have assumed that he was, but he was never told that. Bret Hart in 1993 was not the draw that he would go on to become. And even the draw that he would go on to become, he was never the draw that Hulk Hogan was. And when you're a promoter and business is down, you fall back on your top attraction. It may not be the most popular move, and I think Hogan is a selfish asshole who didn't give a single fuck about helping build new stars. He was interested in keeping Hulk Hogan strong. Yeah, he didn't care about what the WWF roster was going to look like in the future because he was leaving anyway. He wasn't sticking around. But as a business move, I understand why they did what they did. What really would have been best for business would have been to have Hogan put their next big star over clean. Whether that was Yokozuna, whether that was Bret Hart. Yeah, he lost to Yokozuna. He put him over, but only after a camera exploded in his face. That's who Hogan is. Had he stayed, the new generation that followed never would have been able to climb the mountain the way they did with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Diesel and all of these guys. Hogan never would have allowed it. Never. He had to leave so that a new era could thrive. And it didn't happen right away. It took several years. There were some lean years there during the new generation period. Fucking 1995. Like, there were some tough times. But the best thing that ever happened to Vince McMahon during that period, outside of being acquitted, was Hogan leaving. Which sounds kind of weird, but it's true. Like, he probably didn't feel that way at the time. But look at everything that followed. Like, even Hogan going to WCW and forming the NWO, all of that played a role in the eventual rise of stars like Stone Cold and The Rock. They were getting their asses handed to them. They had to create new stars. They were forced. They had their backs against the wall. The company could have gone under. They had to create new stars. Imagine if Hogan stuck around and you have people like Austin on the ascent. Do you think he would have allowed Stone Cold to get as big as he did? He had to leave. But I enjoyed this. And if you're into the behind-the-scenes stuff, you will too. There's some of the usual fluff, but I think they kept it to a minimum. Again, WrestleMania 9 may be the worst WrestleMania when it comes to match finishes. I mean, there's so many terrible finishes on the show. But I can't call it the worst WrestleMania of all time. Like, even the bad stuff, it's never boring. There's nothing worse than a boring WrestleMania. There's some bad stuff here, but it's never boring.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Jon Moxley, in case you couldn't tell, is still the AEW World Heavyweight Champ. That means we have another month of this Death Riders bullshit, and I can barely stomach it. Swerve Strickland is going to Dynasty. He will challenge Jon Moxley for that title, and he better fucking win. He's the right man for the job. Honestly, anybody would be the right man for the job. The Maytag Man would be the right man for the job right now. The Orkin Man would be the right man for the job right now. I could walk out my front door right now. I could go five blocks down the street. First fucking guy that I see, maybe he's got a bottle of beer in a brown paper bag, whatever it is. I'll grab him. He would be the man for the job. I would have preferred the Rizzler come out and sign his name to that contract and pin Jon Moxley to win the AEW World title. I would have taken Big Boom AJ as the AEW World Champion.
Who ate my double-tongued chocolate cookie?
Can you imagine the heads that would explode if that happened? Anybody but what they're doing now, anybody but Moxley, anybody but the Death Rider stuff, we need to move on from this.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007.
Bringing you the good,
the bad,
and the ugly. Check out the weekly live streams, bonus content for subscribers, and follow The Solomonster on Facebook, Instagram, and X. The Solomonster.
I love you so long.